Coming to you live from my apartment, it's Rob Has a Podcast. And now here's the guy who doesn't want Big Wendy to know about his boring chicken every night. I am Rob Cesternino. Hello, everybody. How are you? We have got a show for you today, and it's going to be a little bit different than what you're used to here, as we have a highly anticipated interview here on the podcast. I'm going to be talking with Spencer Bledsoe. People have been waiting to hear from him, waiting to find out everything that's going on with him, and we are going to deliver exactly that here in this podcast. I will just give you a heads up here that we are not, and sometimes I record these intros to the podcast after I do the interview. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about this week's episode of Survivor. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about Spencer, everything he's been through, his personal journey. And this is not going to be a podcast that is for everybody, but if you are into a conversation that is going to be very wide in scope and may blow your mind in certain areas, then this could be a podcast that's for you. I thought it was a fascinating discussion with Spencer, and if you are a fan of his, I think that you will be very interested to hear about his long, strange trip to get to this point in his life. So that's what's coming up here today. I will bring you that interview in a moment. And if you're dying for the Survivor talk and you say, hey, Rob, Survivor podcast, hey, where is the Survivor? Good news. Johnny Fairplay is coming up on the Survivor Feedback Show. Get your feedback questions in. Talk to him on Friday. I'm going to talk to Megan Z on the new This Week in Survivor podcast. Talk about Megan's thoughts on the season. Talk about social media. We'll play This Week in Survivor History. And then we still have the wiggle room to go, not to mention the Survivor know-it-alls from last night. So still three other all Survivor podcasts still to come this week, and one that we did last night. So hopefully everyone is going to enjoy what we have for you this week. Before we get to Spencer, let me take a moment and thank our sponsor for this episode of our podcast, and those are friends over at Tommy John. Tommy John is the maker of the most comfortable underwear. When men and women upgrade from their tattered, outdated multi-pack underwear to Tommy John, you get the most comfortable underwear on the planet. They have a lot to say about it. This is what some people have said about Tommy John. Scott was so happy his double agents are no longer going rogue. Melissa, whose Tommy Johns are so light and comfortable, she worries she'll forget to pull them down when she goes to the bathroom. The point is, men and women all across America are crazy about Tommy John underwear. Tommy John sent me some underwear to try. I don't know how many of you want to imagine me in underwear, but I have to say that it was a big hit here at my house. Really enjoyed the Tommy John underwear. They fit great, super comfortable, lightweight. Both Tommy John men in underwear sport a no wedgie guarantee. Where else are you going to get a no wedgie guarantee? I wish I could have gotten one in high school. Comfortable stay put waistbands and a range of fabrics that are luxuriously soft and designed to move with you. Plus, Tommy John has dress shirts and undershirts that stay tucked, ridiculously soft loungewear and go anywhere apparel that's versatile enough from the go to the boardroom to a boxing class. And for ladies, the new Air collection is made from quick-drying antimicrobial fabric with seamless bonded edges that offer a no-visible panty line guarantee. Tommy John is so sure you're going to love the fit and feel that it's all backed by their best pair you ever wear or its free guarantee. That means if you don't love your first pair, you get a full refund. Tommy John, no adjustment needed. Hurry to TommyJohn.com/Rob now for 20% of your first order. That's TommyJohn.com/Rob for 20% off. TommyJohn.com/Rob. All right. And with that, I'm just going to throw it to my conversation with Spencer, which, as you'll hear, is already in progress.
Let me just get a...
What tea do you drink?
I think the mug is more important than the tea, isn't
yes.
it?
Yeah, the Rob's Podcast mug.
But yeah, ginger tea right now.
Ginger tea?
Yeah, a little bit of ayahuasca in it, but it's just ginger tea primarily.
Now, are you being serious about the ayahuasca?
In my tea that I'm drinking right now while talking to you?
Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about ayahuasca.
No, dude. I would be okay.
You think I know about psychedelics?
I mean, you hang out with Aris.
Well, I haven't seen Aris in how many years? I mean, he's doing great, but you know,
can we put this like pre-show banter on the podcast? I feel like this is better than the podcast.
Sure. Do you want to keep this side? I did this with an interview recently. Okay, this is it. All right, you're listening to Spencer Bledsoe. Here on Rob's podcast.
Now I feel weird. Like, and now, like, you've made it a podcast and not a real conversation.
Sorry about that. Well, do you want to go? You want me to edit that part out?
No, because I guess people have to know that it's a podcast.
We have to start.
Do people have to know? Do we have to? Yeah. Okay. All right. We can start.
Okay, Spencer. How have you been? Good.
In the meta, yeah, I've been well. In the last week, like, really horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But we can get into that. But yeah, like I've been doing pretty well since I guess you've heard me last.
Okay. Why are you doing horrible? Because I think that there's you're a very layered guy, that there's a lot going on with you right now. And, you know, I've been, you know, counting down the days to finally get a chance to talk to you. When we first said we were going to do this, it was like a week and a half ago. And you were like,
yeah,
that's so far away. I'm like, dude. It's like 10 days from now. But then, you know, as we got closer, I'm like, oh, man, I wish I was talking to Spencer today.
Yeah, I think like I was so in the moment because I, you know, was still on my mushroom thing. Like, and by the way, I'm not like a huge psychedelic guy.
That was real. Okay.
Yeah, I haven't gone full Aris, but yeah, that was my foray, my venture into psychedelics. And that wasn't like... I'm hesitant. I don't know. I don't even love leading with that because I feel like people immediately have all these preconceived notions. They're like, oh, is Spencer a druggie now? Is he super into psychedelics now? They're like looking for something to define me, looking for some kind of label that encapsulates what I'm all about.
Right.
But I really like, I see that as just one thing in a long line of spiritual questing and kind of soul searching, like meditating, and Survivor plays a part of that too.
And I saw you back in December. We had a very nice lunch at Jerry's Deli.
Yeah.
And you were telling me...
And you paid for it. I appreciate it.
Well, I'll pay for your lunch anytime you want to have one. But you were telling me how you just got back from that you had been meditating in... correct me if I'm wrong. In Tibet with monks, that you wanted to learn more about how to meditate. And I said,
no, everyone thinks, I don't know, everyone always thinks Tibet, but I've never said Tibet. That's the same thing happened at my work, funny enough. Everyone thinks I just moved to Tibet and became
Where did you go to learn how to meditate?
Nepal.
Okay.
So I mean, I guess they're not that far off. They get their third world countries mixed up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was in Nepal, and that kind of like, I don't know, so around the time of Cambodia, I got really into meditation. Before Cambodia, I got into meditation out of this vague idea that, oh, the science says it's good and maybe I'll win Survivor if I'm super centered. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And then after Cambodia, I was pretty devastated and I turned back to meditation, this time with a little bit more of a focus on finding something, like a little bit of a seeking and looking for some kind of meaning, because, you know, I was a guy who throughout childhood just put meaning into everything I did, like, and it goes back to relationships with parents and stuff, but Survivor became like my meaning. I don't know if you remember, like, when you saw me after the finale of Cambodia on the red carpet, when I was just like a shell of a person, devastated at losing this game show. And I remember you looking at me and being like, Spencer, why don't you like chill the hell out? Like, you just lost Survivor.
I don't think those are my exact words, but my relationship with you has been, you know, a long one at this point. And, you know, that you were, you know, a very, you know, young person when you, and you're still a young person, but you, that, you know, it's over 5 years now that, I've gotten the chance to know you. And I feel like that, I feel like I've known three Spencers where the Spencer that, you know, went out to go play Survivor the first time, that really was, you know, the young lad who, and you had so much, you know, exuberance and were coming off of this, you know, whirlwind adventure. And you had, you know, so much excitement, and, you know, that was, mm-hmm. you know, this, you know, really, you know, fun young person with all this energy. But then after you went to go play Survivor, you know, you came away and you had such a sadness about the whole experience. Mm-hmm. I remember that you were so bummed out, and you didn't win, but you went so far in the game, you know, got all the way to the end where it would have been so difficult just to beat how you did the first time. And you ended up coming so close. And I wasn't sure if it was from the fans or because the jury kind of beat you up exactly, or if you were disappointed about, you know, how it played out. But then I felt that you, you know, were very, you know, sad and somber after that. Mm-hmm. And now this mm-hmm. is a third Spencer that we're coming to get to know,
I guess. I can tell you why it was. It'll just take a few minutes. If
sure.
You're with that.
We have nothing but time to talk today.
I guess we do have a lot of time.
Yeah.
You know, so
by the way, Chris got voted out of Survivor. Okay. He's on Redemption Island, and we'll talk about him.
Oh yeah. Eventually. Right. Yeah. No, he's not on Redemption Island. He's on the edge.
You know what I mean?
You gotta get it right.
Everybody knows.
I always think that, like, if someone tried to watch Survivor now, they would be like just so confused, because they're like watching this indie film almost, where there's like a legacy advantage and an idol nullifier, and like, oh, this is the Island of Extinction, this is the Redemption Island, Exile Island, mm-hmm. Ghost Island. Like, I think anyone who tried to watch the show just starting now with no background would just be completely lost.
Yeah. How many people are jumping in on season 38 though?
Not many. And maybe that's like, I don't know, is that good? Like, when you see like, oh, now it's Final Four, so they all have to like try and make burn stuff, like maybe it's time, maybe it could be good to have like a back to basic season just to get some new viewers who, I don't know, whatever, that's another conversation. But yeah, like Survivor like came to be so important in my life because the things that normally are important in a person's life were extremely unstable for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I grew up and I was in this home where my parents got divorced when I was four. There were like four divorces between the two of them, and it was just absolute chaos. It was absolute entropy, I like to say,
mm-hmm.
Because that's like a parallel between psychedelics and meditation and all of those things and what my lived experience was when I first started growing up. Like, there's this balance. If you want like psychological validation, there's a paper called The Entropic Brain by Robin Carhart Harris that's really good on this. But there's this balance between entropy and order, and a kid is born and is just like full-on entropy, childlike, making meaning of everything. They're just a sponge ready to make meaning of every single thing. And then over the course of a life, you have parents who are like, oh, this is a dog, this is you, this is me, and they teach identification, they teach all of these social constructs, and many of those are painful, you know, gender, race, all that stuff, and you slowly move toward order. But I was just in like full entropy when I was really little, and my parents split up, and then, you know, at my mom's house there was just a ton of shit going on. There was drug abuse, there was like all this conspiratorial feeling and people talking about people behind their backs, and it was really Survivor-esque.
Mm-hmm.
Really Survivor-esque. And at a certain point I said, okay, my dad can be my safe haven. This is craziness, so I'm just gonna think about my dad's house as like the safe place. And then it got to a point where I realized, holy shit, like, my dad's a huge alcoholic destroying his health, and has a ton of issues of his own, and this is not safe.
Mm-hmm.
And around 10 or 11, I started getting extremely depressed, because what I thought, like, everything I turned to turned out to be unstable or on the decline or not who I wanted to be in terms of, you know, someone to emulate. And so I turned to TV, I turned to media, and I started idolizing people. Like, if there was like a male figure on a TV show, I would like really look up to that guy. And I would be like, okay, that's someone I could be like. And I just cycled, you know, type of person after type of person. And I also retreated. I went into like rationality and chess. Like, even from age four, I would ask my mom to make me math tests on the weekend. I would ask, mm-hmm. like, what's the biggest number? Is there any number smaller than zero? I really loved just like abstract math. And chess was just like a natural extension of that. So I was all about, you know, being the best at that. And then,
because there was logic and stability there. Is that
exactly
why? Yeah.
I mean, numbers weren't going to hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like anything that was predictable that I could make sense of, and that there was always going to be an explanation. Even if I lose, there's an explanation at least as to why I lost. I can put it in Fritz or some chess engine and understand. That was extremely comforting. And I just like retreated into that world and lived in that world. And then finance and the interest in making money and being a trader came out of that. And then being obsessed with academia, economics, UChicago, like all of this was this identity I had sort of propped up and built up. And that was the identity, if you, as you like to call it, Spencer version number one, mm-hmm. that I used to get on Survivor. And I thought like Survivor to me was like, I thought it would be like where I would find some sort of salvation.
Yeah.
I thought, to be honest with you, and it sounds embarrassing and stupid, but like that's how my mind was thinking. I was thinking like, if I got on this show and I could actually be the guy who I kept looking to as someone you're supposed to be, that I guess would be like growing up. That would be, that's what I should do. And so I got so into, you know, I was just like hyped up and I went into Kagyan and then got, you know, like had a lot of ups and downs and stuff. But what I never saw coming is that Survivor was truly like a psychoanalytic process, if you let it be. Like introspection is possible through Survivor, and like probably 80% of people who go on Survivor don't look at it that way, but if you do,
I think that number a little bit,
yeah. I think it's possible. I think it holds. I mean, producers probably like to think it's more possible than it is, but I think it's absolutely possible. Like when I memories started come to me during Survivor, mm-hmm. like during the
you know, 38 yes. days of, you know, being on the, or 37 days of being on the island. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. During filming, like during the merge feast, I ate all this food after starving. And then I got pulled for a confessional and they were like, how are you feeling? And I was like, this is really weird, but like, I'm feeling really guilty. I don't mm-hmm. know why, but I feel super guilty. And then I like flash back to this memory of like age 9, I got this marble chess set as a gift for my birthday. And I just started like crying because I felt like I didn't deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, holy shit. They're like, I have some serious issues. I have some serious self-esteem issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so began this kind of search for meaning. And the answer wasn't going on again and trying to win, but in a way it was, because after Cambodia, I was just so broken down that I had no choice but to just keep searching for whatever I was looking for in meditation and in spiritual practices. Meditating every day, going on a 10-day retreat, a Goenka retreat, going to Nepal. And I think like the last week, and it's not as if my whole life has been like some bleak victim story, not at all. I've had a great life, but like the last week I would say has been like a culmination of that search. And I kind of went back into this mode of entropy. I went home and I don't know. I think I'm throwing too much at you at once.
No, but, I think we're all along for the ride.
I'm just trying to make the ride like linear-ish, but that's just not how brains work. That's mm-hmm. the issue, is like there's this whole game I feel like we have to play in discourse and conversation where we have to like make it linear and make it a progressive story so that we sound normal and sound sane. But brains just don't work that way. Brains mm-hmm. work through association. Like if you want to brainstorm, much better than writing out a list is doing a mind map and just writing down what you're thinking and then writing down the very next thing you're thinking, the very next thing you're thinking, and then drawing links between the different things and seeing how your mind actually maps it out. And then from that, you can figure out how to tell a story. I haven't done that, so that's why perhaps this is nonlinear. But yeah, like I'm trying to give you the best story I can, but also part of this journey has been realizing that posturing and trying to give strangers I've never met the best story I can has been like very bad for my mm-hmm. mental health. And like, I think that's probably where what you saw in like all my social media shenanigans.
Well, I'd love to hear more about that, but you know, yeah. You talked about, you know, why this week was especially, so sure. hard on you. And I think that people are probably on the edge of their seat, forget the edge of extinction, about you know what's happened.
Yeah, okay. So I mean, first of all, mushrooms put you on the edge of extinction in a sense, because they, if you take enough, you can get ego death. That did not happen to me. But they bring you toward that point where your structures and all of the order you've created gets shattered and you go into full entropy. So on top of going into full entropy and just trying to make meaning of things, on Thursday, and this is where I like really relate to you. On Thursday, I had this urge to call my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And I called my dad, and he said that he was doing really badly, that he hadn't eaten for a week, mm-hmm. and that he basically said, like, this might be it. This might be the end.
Mm-hmm.
And this wasn't like out of left field for me, because the last 2 years have been kind of like this hell of my dad being on the brink of dying, it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
Where, I mean, I quit my job in part because of this. Mm-hmm. And 2018 was the worst year of my life in large part because of this. But he's been in the ICU like 5 times. He's been an alcoholic my whole life. And so the actual medical issues now are heart problems, neuropathy. He can't feel his legs. He can't move around or walk around. He has no appetite. He spits up and throws up. And he's like living a miserable existence. But I mean, alcohol is kind of the hinge point, the lifestyle practice that allowed for all of this to fall apart. So in this past week, you know, I talked to him on Thursday, and he said that he felt like this might be it. And so I flew immediately home to Atlanta, and my girlfriend Kaylee came with me. This week I had been like had insomnia. I had been sleeping like maybe 3 hours a night. My head was just spinning.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Atlanta, and I went to him, and my sister was there too, and we were trying to help him out. We had all this food arranged. She like bought the food. I didn't do much, but we were trying to get him to eat. We were trying to get him to drink water, and he was just refusing. He was just saying like, no, I'm not touching any of that crap. Real spiteful, real just like in his own world and not letting any love in. And I don't know. I did say like, look, Dad, if you stop drinking, this could get better, because mm-hmm. I feel like I have to say that. I don't want to just walk on eggshells and not throw out the lifeline.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't take the lifeline. And at that point, I don't know, I feel like something just kind of like flipped, where I realized, you know, it's been 2 years of this sort of thing, and I can't keep living my life this way. I have to accept that he is not accepting my help. And, you know, I know that your story that you've shared on here that really touched me was about wanting to just tell your dad that you loved him and that you hadn't always been able to connect and emote, you know, how mm-hmm. you wished. But I kind of felt similar, that, you know, all my dad did when we were with him was drink and watch movies. And if that's the only way he'll connect with me, I just wanted to do that one more time. So I just watched a movie with him and sat there and drank my water while he spat up whatever. And it wasn't like we had this huge heart to heart or big catharsis, but I felt like we did connect one more time. You know, we kind of like saw each other, and he knows that he's doing this to himself deep down, even though he's in denial and has cognitive dissonance and won't admit it. He knows. And we just kind of sat in this space of accepting it, and I felt like a lot of guilt
mm-hmm.
go away, wash through me, because like I've always felt guilty for a lot of my family's fucked up, and I've always felt guilty for individuating and going and doing my own thing and generally being okay.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like, what did I do to deserve to be okay when everyone I love is, you know, not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I found some validation in that decision that I made when I was starting college to go away and to have my own life. And I love all those people. I care about all those people. But I just realized none of my parental figures really, they were in so much pain and had so much of their own crap to deal with that they couldn't give me what I needed as a kid. And I had to go into a little bit of that entropic like kid mode as an adult to process that's okay, and I can make my own way, and I'm allowed to be happy, even though I'll always help these people as much as I can. And I mean, like, survivors honestly have been incredible during this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it makes me rethink family. Not that my family is not my family, but also survivors, my family, like 30 people, at least, reached out, some of whom I didn't even know that well, reached out and just like wrote so much, support and just understood me. And I don't know, I think there's something to that. I think like a lot of, not everyone, but I think a lot of people who turn to something like Survivor or turn to reality TV for meaning in their lives are in some kind of a similar situation searching. And we have this bond and this shared wound and care about each other.
Yeah. Well, I do think that there are a lot of people that have something missing, seek this out. And I think that there are a lot of people that listen to the podcast that think about how one day I'm going to be on the show. I'm going to get through casting. I'm going to make my tape. Right. And I think that, they're also chasing something. And I know that, you know, that's how I ended up there, where I felt like, you know, very stuck in where I was in the world. And I felt like that my, you know, my way out of where I was, and then, the longing that I had was going to be to ultimately, you know, get on one of these shows and then ultimately, you know, figure it out from there. So I do think that we all do have that, you know, misfit toys element to us.
Yeah. And like, I remember you saying that your dad just like loved that you were on Survivor. Like, he thought that was really cool.
Yeah, he did.
Kind of connect over that.
Yeah.
And like, my dad was the same way. Like, he had all the buffs. He would like, when we would be on beach vacations, he would like go up to strangers and be like, you know, my son was on Survivor.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was cringeworthy for me, but I don't know. He was a pro athlete. Mm-hmm. So I felt like he kind of saw it as like my sport, and that was some way that we like related in a way we hadn't before.
Yeah, I think my dad thought I was kind of a loser before I was on a TV show. Like, I don't think he really thought I was capable of doing too much. Like, he had wanted me to go to school for like business or something like that, and, you know, have like a more respectable. But he was, you know, super thrilled that I went on the show, and then he took it really hard when I didn't do well. The second time around. Did you face any of that? Did you feel like that you let people down when you didn't win the second time?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I tried to process it because I was devastated enough myself. But like, yeah, my dad was like, at the Cambodia finale, he was just plastered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that wasn't abnormal, but he was especially plastered.
Mm-hmm.
And he apparently, like, you know, all the families and all the loved ones of the survivors are always hanging out at the finales because you've got your six guests. And so he saw Val and was like, I need to talk to Jeremy. I need to have a conversation with Jeremy.
Mm-hmm.
And so Val thought it was this huge thing where my dad was like super pissed, super livid. And Jeremy comes by and is like, you know, saying what's up to my dad. And my dad's just like, hey, man, congrats. I just wanted to say congrats.
Mm-hmm.
but yeah, like I think he was bummed, but it was a fun thing for everyone. I mean, it's as fun as you let it be, right? Because like, your perspective there was that, I mean, you still did pretty well, and you can just enjoy this. And I think I got so wrapped up in like Reddit and what people think and what people say. And by the way, like, many survivors get wrapped up in that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
They pretend they don't. Like, they all do. It affects all of us. I think I just didn't have the wisdom you had to like be able to cut that faucet off and know that like the people you're talking to face to face are the ones that, you know, that you can have a real human connection with.
Yeah, well, let's not assign too much wisdom to myself, because I think that when I was probably, you know, older than you were when you played the second time, you know, I didn't have such a great go of it, and had a, you know, it took a long time.
Yeah,
for
you
me
also
to
had
process.
A tougher thing happen. I mean, I don't know, like for a guy with your name to basically like vote you out and then do everything you wish you could do.
Well, you know, I don't know if I was going to get married, but
you know what I mean.
Yeah. Your dad, how is he doing now? Is it a grim prognosis?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, in the long term, sure. But he got out of the hospital. He ended up going to the hospital, which... he's, you know, like, I really am a big believer in like home care. I actually think a lot of the things that institutions do, you can do better with just enough know-how at home. and I'm not knocking, like, go to the institutions and the professionals and the psychiatrists and stuff if and as you need to. Like, I'm probably going to do a little therapy. But I'm a big believer in, like, home care, and that's why I was disappointed my dad didn't accept that. But he's, like, you know, he's full order. He's on that order end of the spectrum where he just believes in whatever doctors tell him. And so he went to the hospital, and they, like, I assume pumped his stomach. And he just got out last night, and he's sleeping now. I talked to him earlier. It's his birthday today, actually.
Okay.
So it's nice that he can be in his own bed for that.
Yeah. Will you stay in Atlanta now?
No. I'm in Chicago now.
Oh, okay. You're back home.
I just got back to Chicago. Okay. I mean, after like trying to help my dad, I went to my mom's, and I was in this situation where I was in a really dark place. Mm-hmm. I was like, I was having panic attacks each day, multiple panic attacks a few days. And I like at one point it got so bad that I was just like, I was like crying for help. And mm-hmm. no one in that environment was able to really help me.
How recent was this?
This was, I guess, Monday.
Okay.
Or Saturday is when it was really bad. And I was like, you know, just trying to ask for someone to, like, you know, could you please, like, get me water or something, or just like a sleeping pill. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't getting that. I literally felt like unprocessed trauma was coming up, and I was living through it and dealing with it now, because like that's kind of how I felt as a kid. Like, someone helped me and no one would help me. Mm-hmm. And I just came to the conclusion, all right, I know I've slept 15 hours in the last 9 days, but I'll drive to CVS, I'll get a sleeping pill, I'll like go home and take it. And like I did that, and then it was really a good decision to come back to Chicago, because mm-hmm. since I've been in Chicago, I've been sleeping regularly, I've been feeling better each day. Like, still a little bit of difficulty, but I'm back to daily meditation. I'm feeling much, much better. That is, you know, hanging in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, I feel like that you've studied all of this, you know, ways to be enlightened, and, you know, you've gone on this journey, and I feel like you've learned so much about the world. What is the takeaway that you want people to have from all this?
I think, well, one takeaway is that there's a danger in having a takeaway. Because if I give you a discrete answer right now,
that's more meaning
for people to cling to.
Right.
If I say meditation, then some people will be like, oh, I must meditate. And other people will be like, oh, fuck Spencer. Meditation is some hippie wackadoo nonsense. So there's no one answer. But I mean, I found so many things helpful. Yoga, meditation, real yoga. So not just asana, the Western version of yoga that emphasizes movement and physicality, but also breath work and the yogas that relate to that. Honestly, psychedelics can help. And
we don't want to
make me that guy. I'm not giving you any advice on drugs. Don't do anything illegal. There's a lot of research coming out, and it's like, it's a pretty exciting time to be like, I'm in graduate school now studying mental health and studying meditation. And it is an exciting time to look at it. Like, Michael Pollan just wrote a book, Changing Your Mind, about this subject and about the many studies that have been done on psilocybin, ayahuasca, and a lot of different stuff, and how that, you know, can change how you think about death. It can help you deal with loved ones passing. Obviously you always want to be smart about it. You do not like, it was not smart of me to just do this on my own without like someone helping me through. Like, there's a reason a lot of these things are, you know, in Ecuador with a shaman who has seen thousands of these things happen. And a lot of people like might even be writing me off now just for even broaching this topic because it's so stigmatized. But I think with just sticking to mental health, which is what I have been studying for longer, I think we need to get a lesson and a sense that we don't know nearly as much as we culturally think we know.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's this sense, and not even so much from psychiatrists and psychologists, more often from the public and their perception of psychiatrists and psychologists, but there's this perception that, oh, you know, the science has it all figured out, and all these mental disorders are just a matter of brain chemistry and a chemical imbalance. You need a medication and they can help you with that, fix your brain chemistry. A problem and a solution. It's a very Western thing, a problem and a solution. And I'm not going to bash the West here because I think the West is awesome. Like, problems and solutions have done a lot of great things for medicine, heart medicine, dentistry. Mm-hmm. People often make this mistake where they either go full homeopathic, fuck Western medicine, or they go full Western medicine, you know, kind of like my dad. But the problem and the solution paradigm has issues, because when you conceive of any behavior that's deviant or outside of the norm or doesn't seem to add up or that's nonlinear as a mental disorder or as, I don't know, schizophrenia or depression or something clinical, something that's fundamentally flawed with you, I think that's a very disempowering message. I think it's very disempowering to tell someone there's some endogenous thing in your brain that is stopping you from living the life you want to live, and there's nothing you can do about it but defer to authority. Just defer to the psychiatrists and the people who know. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of what I want to undermine, and undermine tepidly and with nuance, because I think you should still use those resources in mental health, but undermine insofar as it's not as if we knew what depression was and then came up with solutions to fix it. The way this all happened was in the 1950s, there were medical trials going on with blood pressure patients and with tubercular patients, and they tried out a few experimental drugs that included serotonin, that affected serotonin levels. And they incidentally found that people who had their serotonin go up seemed to be in good spirits. People who had their serotonin go down seemed to be in bad spirits. And then they said, oh, serotonin is the neurotransmitter that affects happiness. Therefore, there's this disease called depression that is a matter of having the right amount of serotonin. And mm-hmm. since then, I've said this before, like on my podcast, maybe even when I told you about my podcast, but like since then, we've realized there's way more nuance. It has to do with neuron genesis and the hippocampus and all these different things. It's super complicated, is the bottom line. And we're still figuring it out. But like a lot of the effect of SSRIs can be placebo, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, that is. Mm-hmm. And so it's worthwhile, I think, you know, still, if you need that, do it. But it's worthwhile to explore these other avenues, to explore, you know, if you can find like an integrative psychologist, or if you want to start a meditation practice, I think that's a great thing to do. I mean, there was this guy, Thomas Soss, who in the 1950s or 60s wrote a paper called The Myth of Mental Illness, which is a really famous paper, got a lot of backlash, where he basically says all of mental illness is bullshit, doesn't exist, it's something we made up. And I'm not going to go that far at all. But I will say that, like, if you look at, there's another paper on being sane in insane places, it's called. This guy, Rosenhan, had a bunch of people go into psych hospitals, psych wards, and say they were dealing with some kind of mental disorder. And then they weren't, by the way. And then see if they can get out. See, like, just act sane and see if they can get out. And the average, I think, was like maybe 40 or 50 days they were locked in there. They were completely written off. They would try and talk about anything they could. They would try and talk about just casual stuff, the weather. And whatever they said, the clinicians, the nurses, or whoever would just assume they were off the rocker or they were spinning some kind of mad story. It's very hard if someone thinks you're insane to show that you're sane. Mm-hmm. And I think right now is a powerful time because we're no longer, you know, most places you can't just force someone into an institution. And we also have incredible freedom of speech today. I mean, freedom of speech today, PC culture aside, is better than it's ever been. You can just get up on YouTube, you can get on a podcast, and you can say this stuff. And I think that's really powerful.
Is that part of your social media campaign here in the last week or so, where because I'm trying to understand, were mixing it up with a ton of different survivors, you were having AMAs on Reddit. Was this just a stress relief, or were you proving a point, or can you talk us through what you were just having fun?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. First and foremost, it was just having fun. For sure, a lot of it was just trolling. But there was a part of it that, like, I wanted to show that I could just say what I felt like saying and that the world would be fine. you know, because for so long, I like before I would podcast with you in the olden days.
Yes.
I would get nervous. I would
Spencer
be like,
1.0.
Yeah. Like, do you remember our first podcast in the studio in LA after the whole like finale?
Of course.
Yeah. Like Frost Nixon. It was just you and me. And I was like really nervous. I wanted to be funny. I wanted people to like me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the social media thing was I just wanted to say what I felt like saying and know that a lot of people care about me and it's fine. And like, if you are offended that I didn't give you the answers you wanted or that, you know, I wasn't interesting enough on Reddit or that my answers were too literal, like, I don't care. And that was empowering for me.
Mm-hmm. From this past experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Because I think that the evolution of people's reaction was, okay, this new Spencer is savage, not the guy that you played on Survivor with. But then there were some people, oh, look, Spencer's trying to get on Survivor 40. Here's the campaign. There comes Spencer that he's come out of the woodwork. And then... Right. I do think that there was a lot of people that came into it was this behavior is concerning. We're worried about Spencer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I appreciate all those people. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I have a different thing to say to all those people. Like, to the people who are worried, I really appreciate your concern. Like, I think that's nice of you. You're a caring person. But you really don't know what's going on in someone's life.
Yeah. You tell people, hey, don't worry about me. Worry about yourself.
Right. That's what I was trying to say, because I did have a hard time, but I was going through it in my way. And like, I think we're way too quick to judge. Basically, I think we're going through this weird process culturally where social media and all these online platforms have shown that there's like a lot of shit out there. People think crazy thoughts, and we are still coming around to accept that. And that's where you see like people getting really, you know, really mad about little things because the little things seem to represent big things, and getting tribal where like if someone says they have this political opinion, you immediately assume all their other political opinions. You assume the candidate they support. You assume they're like supporting Trump or something and they're a Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're still going through this growth process where we need to accept that our minds do crazy stuff. We need to accept that we're all a little crazy. That if you were to broadcast every single thought you have, people would be just as concerned about you.
Mm-hmm.
If you were that authentic where you just broadcast everywhere your mind goes, it would be jarring because our minds do wild stuff. And all of human life is kind of this process of filtering it, of saying, no, that's something we're going to just let the mind do. And this is something we're going to channel and express and share. And I just came to do that to such an extent that I had to stop doing that for a second, recalibrate, and realize that I have a choice here. But to people who were alarmed, I appreciate your concern. And to people who think I'm campaigning for season 40, I already said I wouldn't go on Survivor again.
Okay. But I think this is interesting because it sounds like that you felt like a pressure when you first went through the Survivor experience to, mm-hmm. you know, say the perfect thing and, mm-hmm. you know, make everybody happy with what you were saying. And
everyone laugh at least.
We put the title on you. You were literally Mr. Survivor at one point. The belt, you're holding up. I'm watching Spencer on video. You're holding up the belt. I was going to,
yeah, Rob, mystery. Look, like, it wasn't the fact that the Mr. Survivor competition ended right after I won, was that coincidence or was it just incredible tact to be the permanent Mr. Survivor? I guess we'll never know.
But yeah.
I do possess the belt.
You nailed it. And now you've come to a place where you don't care necessarily, or maybe you care, but you're not super interested in what other people think about what you have to say. And you're not worried about trying to be perfect for other people.
More nuanced than that. Like, I care what you think, Rob, because you're my friend.
Yes. Well, thank you, Spencer.
And, you know, I think I care about what everyone thinks to an extent. If I were to model this, because that's kind of what I'm all about. I'm a real, like, mathematical model-y guy.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, like, best friends, closest people, I care quite a bit what they think. I take their feedback very seriously. Friends, I care. People I've met in person, I care.
people on the internet I've never met, maybe the consensus of that, if everyone's saying the same thing, then I'll take that into account and I'll contemplate on it. Mm-hmm. But I care extremely little. And I care the most about what I think of me, because frankly, like, you have to trust yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, no one's going to believe in you. If you believe in yourself, people will believe in you. Mm-hmm. So that power can be used for bad or for good. But I think it's really important to believe in yourself and to stay true to what you think. Like, and even if people who are important to you, if family members vehemently disagree with you, to take that into account and decide where you land. Because like, if you just look elsewhere for guidance, or if you try and please everyone, that's the surest way to be miserable, is to try and be happy by collecting others telling you you're good.
Mm-hmm. So how will you move forward with all of this? That are you going to stay on social media? Are you going to keep mixing it up? Is it sort of like, because it feels like that it has captured your attention now, but I feel like that in, you know, a couple of days or a couple of weeks that you're going to, you know, throw yourself back into something else.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think, like, they say there's this book, and by the way, I'm not enlightened or anything, but there's this book called First Enlightenment, Then the Laundry. And it's about like, not that much externally necessarily changes when you do this stuff. You could be a lot happier. And I'm definitely on the path toward being a lot happier. I'm a lot happier than I was. But it's not going to change that much. I'm going to finish grad school. Gonna meditate every day, gonna hang out with friends, my girlfriend, and you know, I'll see. I'm not gonna plan too much. Previously, I would try and like plan out life. I would have 3-year, 4-year plans that charted out every month and had like probability waves, almost like I was in quantum mechanics or something, trying to see what was gonna happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm not doing that anymore either. I'm finding some kind of balance between being a crazy Western scientifically minded guy who's going to podcast and write a book and living in the now, as mm-hmm. Eckhart would say, as Eckhart Tolle would say.
Yeah, I know you tweet a lot about Eckhart Tolle and the power of now.
Yeah. I mean, dude's a boss. He was way ahead of the curve on a lot of this stuff, I would say.
What is his philosophy?
I haven't read his books, so I've only watched his YouTube videos. And even if I had read his books, I can't speak for the guy. But he thinks it's very important that we've, like, basically through discursive thought and so many things in our busy world, we've forgotten about the present moment. Mm-hmm. And certain things like meditation, yoga, can kind of bring you back into the present moment. And there are degrees to it as well.
Yeah, like, we spend too much time thinking about the future, what's next, or yes. The opposite of that. Yes. We spend too much yes. time thinking about what happened to me. This happened to me. I can't yes. believe. How do yes. I move on? And
brooding,
you know.
Yeah. And I've done a lot of brooding, and I've done a lot of planning, and I've done not that much living in the present moment. And so that's coming back into balance now. And mm-hmm. that's like, that resonates. I think the big thing now, and I think what part of my life purpose is to integrate these things, which are Eastern ideas. I mean, Eckhart Tolle, as brilliant as he is, he just jacked all that stuff from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's not that original. There's no new idea under the sun, but he presented it to the West in a way we would listen to. And I think a lot of what I'm about and what I'm going to do in the world is integrating stuff from psychoanalysis, from Western psychology, psychiatry, from personal development, from models like the writing of Ken Wilber, Spiral Dynamics, with these Eastern ideas and spirituality. And like, there's the integration is there to be done. Like Thomas Insel, who was the head of the APA, said that, you know, when we're depressed, we're ruminating about the past. When we're anxious, we're thinking about the future. And there is a balance to be found in the present moment. And I've had experiences meditating and other stuff that have convinced me beyond any doubt that that's true. I think the challenge is that it's one thing to hear it externally, like mm-hmm. I started meditating because I heard it externally and anecdotally and scientifically, and people said, oh, this stuff is good, you should try it. And I did, but you got to go far enough with it to the point where you get some internal validation, to the point where you actually have reference experiences. And that takes time. Like,
yeah.
If you go to the gym, if you're going to lift weights, you're going to see your muscles get big within a week, and you're going to be like, sweet, it's working. And you're going to keep going.
What gym do you go to, man?
Even that's hard, right? Yeah. Even that's hard. But with meditation, it's especially hard because it might take you 2 or 3 months. before you see anything, but yeah. You will see it. Like after I had been meditating for about a month, I remember very clearly I had this day where everything went wrong, where like my car's wheel went flat. It got towed. I had to go get it. It was raining and pouring. I got drenched. I got mud all over myself. Some interpersonal thing went badly. And I was just like, I'm not loving this, but I'm also like not losing sight of the big picture. Like I'm not that distressed right now.
Mm-hmm.
Shit. Probably it's because I've been meditating for a month straight. And so began, actually coming to believe in this stuff.
Yeah. I've never been able to have luck with it. I've tried a number of times and I feel like I'm just not able to, you know, quiet my mind enough to the point where I can, you know, make any progress with it. But,
you don't have to quiet your mind. I think that's like one of the biggest things that people psych themselves out of meditation. And I'm not even saying you need to meditate. There are so many paths up the mountain. Maybe podcasting is your bliss and you're following your bliss. But like, you don't have to not have thoughts. That's not the goal of meditation at all. It's just to change your relationship to the thoughts. Thoughts will come and you can just see that they came. And if you notice that they came, you're doing it and you're doing it right because you're noticing that they came rather than being lost in them.
Yeah. What I, will tell people if they're looking for something and they think that I have any answers, you know, I feel like, you know, try to find that thing for you, which is the thing that, you know, you end up in that flow state where, you know, you don't even notice the time is like, oh my God, it's been an hour and I'm doing this thing. And I love it. And you're, you know, working towards something. I think if you can, you know, find that thing, I feel like that that's often something that can, you know, help people when they feel like that they're in a rut, not any sort of like, you know, chemical imbalance or anything like that, but where it's like, you know, why am I even getting out of bed today?
Right. Do you feel that way with your work?
I don't think I've ever felt like, why am I getting out? At least not now, but I definitely have felt in the past, like prior to when I was able to get to do this, you know, I didn't know where I was going. I remember a point where, you know, I had moved to Los Angeles and the company that I was working for was struggling. And I just really sort of like looked at, you know, where is this going? What am I doing? And I felt like that I didn't have like any direction. And I remember feeling specifically like, if I knew what I was supposed to do with my life, like I would run in that direction, but I just didn't know where it was. I remember like looking at like a picture of myself. I had been visiting my parents and I was looking at a picture of myself when I was young. And I was just like, it made me very sad to look at a picture of myself as a kid.
Yeah.
And I felt like that I'm going to grow up and I'm going to be aimless of going to be not knowing what I'm supposed to do with myself. And, you know, I've been very lucky that, you know, I've been with Nicole for 15 years and, you know, I feel like that, you know, I always had like, some sort of a, you know, support system around me, but, you know, I definitely have been in that, you know, frame of mind. After I played Survivor the second time, I really was, you know, what do I do with my life now? You know, what do I do? Do I just go back to, you know, working at my old job that I had before? That's not what I want to do. You know, what am I doing?
Right. Yeah. I've definitely been there.
And I think most of the people that are listening have been there in one way or another, at one point in time.
Yeah, I would think so. I think it's like a human struggle. And I guess like, I think you're really right to say like you would not prescribe one thing. I would not prescribe one thing. I would say that for the vast majority of people, meditation is a good, good idea. But also like one barometer you could use is like, is the thing that you're trying now, is it sustainable? Is it something that you need to up the ante? Like if it's cocaine, probably not a great idea because you're going to need to do more and more cocaine to keep getting into that desirable state. Whereas a lot of other things are much more sustainable.
Okay. Spencer has taken us in so many different directions that we've never, things we've never discussed on Rob as a podcast.
He's trying to be the Elon Musk of RHAP.
Is that what you're trying to do? Yeah. I mean, I think that the reactions to this interview so far, I feel like are going to be really far all over the place. Is that what you anticipate, or you aren't even thinking about that?
I haven't been doing much anticipating, which is, I think, the relief and probably why they might be all over the place, because they should be all over the place. Like, if you're having a reaction to this, or if you're contracting and defensive, good, it's working. Mm-hmm. Like, if I'm saying things that are upsetting your ego, but you're still able to listen, that's very good. Mm-hmm. Or okay. If you're like loving it, then I guess stick around. I guess I don't have to give a hard sell to people who are loving it.
Yeah. Have you had any particular interaction with the Survivor alumni on social media that you were very happy with?
I wouldn't say very happy. It was fun to talk about philosophy with Richard Hatch.
Yes.
The idea of like an objective truth and epistemology. That's always really interesting. He's an interesting guy because like
he is a very interesting guy. Yes.
I mean, you can't not be, I guess, if you're the first Survivor winner. I don't know, that even cheapens it, because he's more interesting than that would suggest. But like the first time we met, he kind of like came up to me in the pool at Hearts of Reality.
Uh-oh.
And he was like, Spencer, I'm just really curious about you. What makes you happy?
Mm-hmm.
And I balked a bit. I gave him some answer that maybe sounded smart, but like, I realized that like wasn't sure when he asked me that. And I mean, maybe he was like pushing the pace a bit much and asking me that so boldly, like having not met me. But in retrospect, I really appreciate it, because it kind of like woke me up to the idea that like, I don't know exactly what makes me happy. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten a much better idea of what makes me happy since then.
Yeah.
He's a really fun guy to talk with. We talked on the phone as well. And
recently?
Yeah, like around the time we were tweeting with each other, mm-hmm. just about all these topics.
Yeah.
I would have to talk to him more to like, I don't know, tell you exactly who he is, but
mm-hmm. Yeah. But you guys got into a whole existential conversation about, the nature of meaning and awareness and a bunch of different things, which is probably, Twitter not the best outlet for having. I think that it's a new, very nuanced conversation. I would imagine that. I think it's
tough.
True. Over.
People like miss nuance. Like, I'm shocked at the degree to which people miss sarcasm and miss nuance.
Mm-hmm.
Like even on Reddit, which is a little smarter, but like especially on Twitter, you say something and it's just like you can't have any room for a more sophisticated humor. Like that's why Rupert tweets are successful. Like if you're a survivor and you want to just slay on Twitter and piss everyone off, do Rupert tweets. Just literally tweet like Survivor is on, I'm super excited. You'll get 100 retweets like that, like snapping your fingers, and survivors will resent you for it. But hey, Rupert is rocking the tie dye and, running for governor.
Well, he's
probably going to be the first five-time player of Survivor.
I don't know about that. I don't know if it's going to be Rupert, but
I'm not saying Rupert's an exemplar right here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he's like that. I don't know. Go ahead.
Were you surprised that Jeff Probst got involved with that conversation, that he came in and said, hey, who woke up Richard Hatch?
Well, like, I don't know. In my imagination, the way, if I were to make, is it a simile? If I were to say like survivors are to Reddit and Survivor Sucks and all of those insane subcultures, mm-hmm. as Probst and production are to Twitter. I would bet you he follows stuff, but just has this ego and doesn't want to follow any survivors other than Cochran, because Cochran's the chosen one.
Mm-hmm.
but I bet you he pays attention.
Yeah. How closely do you pay attention to what's going on Survivor over the last couple of years? It's been a while since you and I had a Survivor chat on one of these podcasts. I want to say maybe it was Millennials versus Gen X. Might have been the last time that we did one. Or maybe it was Game Changers.
That was the John Snowboard one.
Okay. I don't remember if we talked during Game Changers because Sarah was back.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think it would have been hard for me too, because... you know the people, but mm-hmm. But yeah, like I've gone full casual, man. Like I, I watch at 7 and then I turn the TV off at 8.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's it.
And that's refreshing. Like, I think if you had a season that was casuals versus super fans, the casuals would slay. I think the super fans would just get annihilated.
Why do you say that?
They would think they know the game so well, and their ideas of what the game is would get in the way of them learning what the game is. You learn by doing. You learn by experience. And I think the people who know they mm-hmm. don't know would absolutely dominate.
But does that come from a place of like self-loathing? Because I think that you are in a lot of ways like sort of like the avatar of the, you know, super fan who goes to go avatar, play Survivor. Yeah.
It's possible. I mean, there's definitely some self-loathing stuff that goes on with being a super fan. Like, if you're a super fan, you're in this process, actually. I would guess. I might mm-hmm. be wrong for some of you, but I would venture to guess if you're a super fan of Survivor, if you're really in it, really hardcore, then you're in this process of looking for meaning in your life. And you actually might. I mean, hey, is it okay if I release this on my podcast too?
Yeah. Whatever you want to do.
Okay. I don't want to be a threat.
Look, if I was going to be getting uptight about, you know, reality stars with podcasts, then I wouldn't get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I'm not a threat to your empire, but if you, I don't know, I think most super fans probably are on this path and would enjoy Redeeming Disorder / the podcast that I'm going to be releasing in the future. Cause there is like some lack of a sense of self that leads you to look, and that led me to look, and that perhaps, yeah, maybe I'm biased in saying that casual fans would beat super fans. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm just like trying to rile people up. I think that's exactly the type of statement that would irk old Spencer.
Yeah. I mean, this is, I feel like when Miley Cyrus went from being Hannah Montana to being, you know, swinging around on a wrecking ball. And this is like a complete,
like what Kelly Wentworth's trying to do this season.
Is that what you feel like Kelly Wentworth is trying to do? What's the opposite Maybe. Of Kelly Wentworth?
Kelly, well, I think Kelly Wentworth is like me in that she did well in Survivor, but also was aware that there was room to improve and aware that connecting with people was going to be essential to that. I might be wrong. She might think she's the best Survivor as she is, but I don't know. That's for her to know.
So this whole conversation started a week or two ago that I was thinking like, oh, okay, well, let me reach out to Spencer and see if you're following what's going on. And I don't remember if you had been tweeting a lot already at that point in time that I had had reached out to you, and I said, what do you think about coming doing the podcast, because Kelly and Joe are there, would be fun to hear you talk about all this stuff. And that was really, I feel like that, the ball really started getting rolling.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so. Are you saying that my social media bender is your doing?
Well, I almost did that. I don't want to like take claim for it, but was that sort of like,
are you the Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtain?
Definitely not. But, I just feel like maybe you dipped a toe back in the water, and then things really were picking up steam.
Well, your theory is that everyone always looks at the person who won their season as the model and then tries to emulate that. It is somewhat Team TV-esque.
Yes. In our initial conversation that you had said, should I text this out? And I said, or should I tweet this out? I said, boy, you're turning into the new Tony.
Yeah, I don't know. But like, Tony is always calling out Tony lookalikes and getting mad at them. He's mm-hmm. like Russell, which mm-hmm. I guess makes Russell correct in his claim that,
well,
Tony's the new
Russell. Back when I did the, an infamous podcast with Russell, his whole thing was that he was mad at Tony, that Tony ripped him off, that Tony went and looked for idols without clue. And if it wasn't for Russell having a bitter jury, he would have been Tony.
But it's like layers. It's like layers, because you get really mad at the first person to try and steal your spotlight. But then the next person to try and steal your spotlight, like Joe Minna, you only get like a little peeved with him. He kind of gets free reign to come in and start his own thing. And that's kind of how I feel about the Survivor podcasting world. You know, mm-hmm. like you've got, and I'm not starting a Survivor podcast, but, Max and Corinne come in, and then like, you've got like Johnny Fairplay, and then like, it's like trickle down podcasting.
All right. Well, I don't want to disparage any other fine survival podcasters.
Like, I'm not saying like hierarchical. I'm saying like they're different niches, and like there's market share more. Like it's more that there's market share. Mm-hmm. Like you had the whole market share for a long time, and then mm-hmm. everyone was like, wait, maybe this thing Rob's been doing for 10 years is like lucrative or something.
There's a niche for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not saying you're the same. I mean, obviously, you're not covering all the same.
Everybody has their lane that they're trying to find. Let's look at this survivor a little bit, and then we'll go back all over the place. How are you doing? You feel good?
Yeah,
you're happy with how this is going so far?
Getting a call. What?
You're happy with how this is going so far?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. Are you?
Yeah, I'm very happy about this. You know, I hope, you know, I had been getting people were, writing to me like, hey, maybe, you shouldn't talk to Spencer right now. Maybe Spencer needs space.
Oh, right. Yeah, I think like probably people got really concerned, and I didn't want to make anyone worried for my mental health.
Okay.
So I am sorry to have caused worry. Like I was initially, again, like messing around and doing all these things, and then the tone changed as the news came.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So you mentioned Kelly is back. You feel like that she is here trying to change the narrative you once tried to do.
No, I don't know that it's about changing the narrative, because like when I went to Cambodia and tried to be this very empathic guy, a lot of people were kind of befuddled. They said, you seemed like you got along with people perfectly fine in Cagayan. I don't see why this is like the thing that needs fixing. It makes no sense. So it wasn't really about changing the story. It was about becoming a better player, because like I wasn't so results oriented that I thought just because people liked me in Cagayan, they were going to continue to like me and that I was going to be good at Survivor. Like the issue, like people liked me in Cagayan because I didn't make any moves, because I like was Tony's puppet, and who doesn't love like a fun loving puppet who's just along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And so in, you know, even though in Cagayan, like if I had made it to the end, I probably would have won. I was like, I had no sway. I was not in control of my own fate. To be in control of your own fate, you have to be like the Don Meehan. You have to make the emotional bonds, preferably without too much like dependency of crying and stuff, so then people don't get pissed at you.
Mm-hmm.
And also preferably not being a mom, because it's a hard role for mom.
Yeah.
But you want to make the emotional bonds, because when you have emotional bonds with people, they'll turn to you. Like you don't control strategy by saying strategy. You control strategy by having people want to tell you their strategy and hope you go along with it. And that's what Jeremy was so good at in Cambodia. And so I kind of anticipated that was a weakness in my game, that even though I went far in Cagayan, there was a lot of luck involved. And if I were better with people with EQ rather than IQ, with social intelligence, I would be better at the game. And that was true. Even though Cambodia went poorly, it was true that was a weakness in my game that I began addressing. I've made a lot more headway in life like since then. But there were the inklings of the change. And I think some people on the jury saw that. Like Cass appreciated that. And she said, you've changed a bit. It doesn't mean I'm going to vote for you, but I see what you're trying to do here. Mm-hmm. And like, there are a few people like Sierra Easton was also very open-minded. Joe was very open-minded and fair. Mm-hmm. Other people were just purely mad.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's the kind of thing that you can change about yourself, in between Survivor appearances? Or is that like something that you need a lifetime to improve upon?
No, fuck that. Like you can definitely improve on it quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Like the younger you are, the quicker you can do it. And the better a mindset you have, the quicker you can do it. I think probably I tried to do it in too short of a window. I didn't quite get there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. Like Survivor was what it was, but I think it's 100% something you can do in a matter of, 5 years.
Mm-hmm. You said, though, that you would never want to play the game again. But do you feel like that you're better equipped now to play than you were when you last went in the second chances?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm way better equipped. I think the problem is the things that have made me better equipped have made me less obsessed with Survivor.
Mm-hmm. That you're casual. You said that they would wipe the floor with the superfans.
Yeah, I think they would absolutely destroy the superfans.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. This feels like that then you're in the right mindset. You're casual. What's the problem?
Well, the problem with like the hypothetical of me on Survivor or with the actuality? The problem with the actuality is the same as it is for you. Like, I like my life.
Mm-hmm.
I lost 10 pounds this week. I don't want to go lose 20, mm-hmm. especially when I'm like a real skinny guy without much to lose.
Yeah. Okay. So,
I mean, it's a two-way street. I mean,
they have to want you.
I'm not going
to
talk about casting right now.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah. but so, Spencer, then do you feel like that overall the Survivor experience was a good thing for you to be a two-time Survivor person? Like, if you did 100%. Not play Survivor, you're a better person today than if you had not gone on that journey.
1,000%. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it pushed me to the edge
of extinction
as far as what I could process. Yeah, emotionally. I mean, like, in Cagayan, you obviously didn't see this, but like on mm-hmm. day 33, 34 or something, I went in the woods and just bawled. I just cried for like 4 hours. I was just like, I'm so broken right now. They don't televise that. Also, they didn't see that. I like snuck away from the cameras.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, I would say it gave me just as much as I could handle as far as the growth, the blind sides. Like, blind sides, I think actually in the long run are therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
I think like being mind fucked like that, having your sense of reality warped like that is how you open your mind and how you ultimately can learn.
Mm-hmm. We've seen in these three episodes that David Wright does not want to work with Kelly Wentworth. He seems to targeting her. It has not worked out. Do you think, is that the right move for a returning player, that you're only one of two returning players on this tribe, that do you like what David is thinking?
No. I'm going to go with no.
Why?
Because I think the returnees are inevitably going to be paired together. I mean, mm-hmm. categorization is happening in the minds of the new players, and they're thinking new player, returnee. Like Survivor, like there's a reason that Survivor brings up all of these social justice issues. It's because it's a matter of categorizations. I mean, you could have tribes based on gender, you could have tribes based on race, maybe only once, and then you lose all your sponsors and mm-hmm. don't do that again.
Mm-hmm.
But you could have tribes based on occupation. It encourages this egotistical, and I'm not using that negatively per se, but this egotistical categorization of groups. And just identity getting very like, I think you should like, I don't know, in Survivor, I think the reason that minorities struggle is because it behooves everybody in Survivor to kind of stick with their identity. Like they like, you have some common ground. It's one way that people find common ground. And so if I were a returning player, I would want every way to find common ground that I could get. And I would want to have an understanding with other returning players.
Can I ask, what is your relationship like with Kelly? Are you guys friendly since Survivor? I feel like that you were tight going in, to the point where I think that you guys were tighter than led on, but then it ultimately didn't work out in the game. And I don't remember the specifics. I think that that she felt like that you guys had one deal and you ultimately wanted to work with Jeremy and Tasha. And then it ultimately was something that you guys were not on the same page by the end of the game.
Yeah, pretty much. I would say that her story factually is 100% correct. I would mm-hmm. say that the missing context is that Kelly and I had some really deep conversations and bonded quite a bit, and that just wasn't shown at
mm-hmm.
all. Like, we had heart-to-hearts about family things. And
yeah.
Like, I think she was right to be that mad at me, because we went very deep and we went very far, and like, it felt okay because she never seemed too emotionally troubled. She seemed very strong through it all.
Mm-hmm.
But I think like there was a subconscious limbic system part of the brain in Kelly that was like, not to be a robot and break her down into physiology. Mm-hmm. But I think there was a part of her that was hurt and didn't show it, that I made such a deep bond and then broke it. Mm-hmm. And that's me speculating. She can correct me, but I think she was probably, it was understandable that she was that mad.
Yeah.
What was the question?
Oh, I just remember talking with, you know, Kelly and listening to interviews that Kelly did after the season. And she seemed, you know, very hurt that you betrayed her. And I felt like she, if again, if this is like trying to remember things that happened, you know, how many seasons ago.
I didn't know if she actually said that. Yeah, I didn't know if she actually said, I think like the story that I got from her more often was Spencer was just a jerk. He was just a prick. He was arrogant mm-hmm. in general. And that kind of bothered me. Because I felt that she was hurt by the way I was with her, but then she acted as if that was like a theme of me, that I was just walking around camp being a dick to everybody. Mm-hmm. And that was not true.
Yeah.
I had very dickish moments, mm-hmm. obviously. Final six, final four, all of that. But that was not the norm. It was the exception. And the exceptions matter. I'm not making excuses, because the exceptions matter. And the fact that that came out of me ultimately swayed the game.
Yeah, from what I remember, that I think that at the point, I don't remember the exact vote, whether it was voting out Abby Maria or the point where that you know, officially jumped to the other side, that mm-hmm. I think that what she was saying was that after that you were very closed off and, you know, not speaking about why, you know, what had gone wrong.
Well, that's true that we didn't speak about that, but it's not, I mean, she didn't ask me, she didn't try and talk to me either.
And
I did say, like, look, I'm sorry about voting you out, but I didn't take it further. I kind of wanted to let her come to me if she wanted.
Mm-hmm. So after Survivor Cambodia, had you had any sort of interaction with Kelly?
Yeah, like text exchanges here and there.
Oh, okay. So friendly enough.
Yeah. I mean, I was like annoyed with her exit interviews for a while, mm-hmm. but I got over it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we're friendly.
Okay. So do you feel like now that she has gotten to the swap here in this season, do you think that she can pick up the pieces now?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I think too many people are holding it as a plan to get rid of her pre-merge.
Mm-hmm.
Like David, and then who's the guy from Georgia who does who's like a radio host, Rick?
Rick, yeah, morning TV, yeah.
Yeah, I like that guy. I think he might win. Mm-hmm. But he also is saying, like, well, this is great that no one knows I'm against Wentworth other than Dave Wright, and we can just keep this as long as we need it. And she's the perfect person to get rid of right before the merge, too.
We saw Chris ultimately get voted out of the game in the episode from this week.
Yeah.
Felt like for Chris, he got dealt a rough hand here where
I felt bad for Chris for sure.
Yeah.
He was great. Like he was nailing the challenges and everything. And that was like a real bummer that just because he wants to be open. I mean, look, it kind of makes you, I'm not going full Aris. Survivor is this environment where all these great traits of openness are punished.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, Woo. Look at Woo.
Yeah. Wu's doing great though now.
Exactly. Wu's doing great now. Like, yeah. Did you see the thing on, I don't remember if it was Twitter or Instagram, but like Wu was like an early investor in Betterment, and Malcolm is like, holy shit, is Wu just...
Was he an investor or he was in the...
He was in the ad,
right.
Yeah, but then Wu was like, invest early, my friend.
Yeah, that I didn't know if he was just saying that that was like the campaign of that people.
Yeah, I guess it's more likely he was just in the ad, but I like to think that Wu was like secretly an angel investor in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, imagine if Wu would have won the $1 million
now.
What he could have turned it into. It could have turned it into $30 million.
He's going to wait till Tony blows his $1 million on, you know, crazy stuff and gambling. And then he's going to fly Tony out to his mansion in the Hollywood Hills and have Tony be his butler.
That would be what a turn of events. Would Tony be a good butler?
I think he'd be a great butler as long as you gave him one job at a time. Mm-hmm. Like if you said, Tony, like, I need you to go to the grocery store and pick up my kids today and tidy up the house. I think probably like your kids would get taken by child services or something.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just said one thing at a time, he'd just be boom. I think he'd be incredibly efficient, impeccable.
does it blow your mind? It's been 5 years now since Survivor Kagiyan, and for whatever reason, that season to me just feels like I have the, you know, warmest feelings about any Survivor season that I've ever done the podcast about Survivor Kagiyan.
Yeah, you know, like me too. Like I knew Kagiyan was a great season during, mm-hmm. and then I came back and was like, this is going to be a great season, guys, and watched it, and it was great. But I think with time, it's gone up and up for me. Maybe it's the nostalgia factor. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like such an awesome season. But it doesn't feel weird that it's been 5 years. If anything, I feel like
feels longer.
10 years. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's wild that this is it. And I think that, you know, for me personally, like there was, you know, so much going on with that. It was, you know, such a rich season with so many characters. Mm-hmm. For me personally, that it was the first season that I was doing the podcast full time, that I had just started doing my Patreon. And so that was like Kagiyan was like the first season where, okay, this is now what I do for my job. This is,
was it the first season you advised a player?
I think so. I'm just trying to think. I don't think I've ever told that story on the podcast.
If you're not comfortable, we don't.
Feel free. That do you?
Yeah, you tell it then. You're a better storyteller.
So, well, I don't know about that, but I was gonna say that I've known you for more than 5 years now, because I actually did get the chance to talk to you before you went to go play in Survivor Kagiyan, and it must have been I guess the summer of 2013.
Yeah,
and I got an email from somebody from like a very suspicious email from a woman. And one of the things that I used to do, because I used to, you know, there was no Patreon, and, you know, I was trying to make ends meet with the podcast, and I didn't really have any ways to monetize the podcast, but I used to, you know, advise people on, you know, their casting video. I'd work with people, and, I almost never do this type of thing now, but I used to have it where people could get a consultation with me. And I'll work on your casting video. And, you know, I worked with, that's how I first met Jordan Parhar, was through doing that. And he, you know, I worked with him on his video, and he ultimately went on to be on the second season of Big Brother Canada, you know, at some point. And then we had a relationship from that. But so I got this woman named Jane had reached out to me. And so I got on the phone with Jane one day in the summer of 2013, and there's like hey, my name's not Jane, but I'm not comfortable telling you what my name is. Like, okay. Okay. Like, all right. Well, you know, you bought the time. So what do you want to talk about? That anonymous person was very concerned about how that, hey, I'm going to go play, or no, it wasn't even, I'm going to go play. Hypothetically speaking, what should I do if I have like a job that, is like, what people are going to be, you know, worried, or like, why am I there? So I need a cover story for what I'm going to do, when I'm there, because, you know, I don't remember if it was exactly that we talked about chess, but it was,
we talked about, like, I think I was trying to convey that, like, I go to a good university and I have like an internship in investment banking, and I don't want people to know.
Mm-hmm. Very concerned about that. And yeah. I think I think my advice was like, well, why don't you just say like you make like YouTube videos or something? Then people will say,
Mari, you wanted me to be voted out second? That's fucked up.
Well, I don't think that's why she got voted out. But so you were very concerned about that. What are people going to think of me? Because I'm going to be so young and I'm going to be on the show and people are going to assume that I'm smart. Little did you know that you were going to be cast on a Brains Tribe.
Right, exactly. Like, and I had a whole story. I did, like, from talking to you. And by the way, your advice was horrible. You were like, I knew it was going to be three tribes because some bonehead in production sent out a Word document of the color of clothing we were supposed to be looking for that was labeled clothing instructions 3.
Yes.
And so I was like, okay.
Well, then.
three or four tribes, but I was like, it's going to be three or four tribes. Mm-hmm. In that situation, how should my strategy be like slightly different? And you were like, I was like, maybe like in that situation, should I try and be like a little more dispersed and talk to like three people at once just to get that four out of six? Or should I like, and you were like, no, I would really like focus on making like one deep bond. Mm. I would really focus on like a real relationship with some guy.
Yeah.
And so then I'm like, okay, yeah, Garrett Adelstein will be like a power couple to mm-hmm. the end. And mm-hmm. then, you know, the rest.
Yeah, how did it work out for you?
Well, Garrett wasn't the best survivor exemplar. Yes. He's a great poker exemplar now.
Yes. And what then?
In Survivor or with... What? Where are we?
I send you on this whole amazing adventure. Two-time survivor, go to the final four.
Oh, yeah. So you want me to say that you're the mastermind behind everything?
No. So yeah, I don't know where I was. I think I probably
Does Jeff know that you pull all the strings.
No, I think that I was. You're not looking at this fourth dimensionally, because I think I was looking at it coming out of, you know, a three tribe format. I probably had just seen, you know, most recently in the Philippines, and I said, okay, well, for Malcolm and Denise, this is what worked.
Yeah,
you know, Rob and Amber.
Well, yeah,
got
but you
together.
Were scripting us into losing. Like, you're Malcolm and Denise, it worked because their tribe got obliterated.
Yeah, and then what did you guys do?
Damn, that was a good comeback.
Yeah, so no, I talked to this shady kid, and he never told me your name, never told me. I think I almost said to Nicole, I said, I think I talked to somebody who's going to go play on Survivor, but I have no idea. And I really had to then piece together from, you know, of like, I think this is the guy that I talked to based on, you know, your, you know, pregame right. stuff.
Well, and based on me leaving voicemails in Blood vs. Water and stuff and saying Jane.
yes. that I ended up putting together. Jane? Why was Jane your fake name?
I think it was just the first name I thought of. I mm-hmm. had a junior high teacher named Jane. She was nuts, by the way.
See, I always thought that you were a Marty Piombo fan and you were making fun of Jane Bright.
Oh, maybe. I did like Marty.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember.
Yeah. Okay. Let me bring it back to Survivor 38, because we got a lot of questions from people wanting to know about your thoughts on War Dog, that he has been talked about as another Tony clone. Do you look at War Dog as being Tony-esque?
I think War Dog is like the full circle moment. It's like the lunar eclipse of Tony's character.
Yes.
So like Russell was the original, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Tony, who was a threat to Russell. And then you had Joe, who was just kind of like there. And then you have War Dog, who I think he's like reinventing the character. Okay. I think this guy's big. I think that's why he's blocking everyone on Twitter now.
Yes, that Tony, I don't believe, who was he? Did he block anybody back in, you know, in his heyday?
No, I mean, do you remember his mantra? It was respect all, fear none.
Respect all, fear none. Yeah, I mean, that he really mixed it up.
I don't block anyone on Twitter. I'm very against blocking on Twitter.
I don't think I have many people blocked, if anybody. I am famously blocked by a number of people, which blows my mind.
Who are you blocked by? That's more interesting.
I don't even have time for the haters, Spencer.
I feel like you're telling me I'm doing a bad job now.
Why?
Because you don't have time for the things I feel like talking about.
Well, I don't want to, dox all of the people that have me blocked on Twitter. I only see them sometimes because then somebody will retweet them. And I was like, hey, what does this tweet say? Why does it say this tweet is unavailable? And then I have to learn the hard way. Like, what? I'm blocked.
That's such a cruel way to learn.
You know, with all of my hate speech on social media, it's understandable why you need to block me.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Spencer, so the Tony, he would famously fight with your cast on Twitter.
Yeah, specifically Cass and myself.
And Sarah.
Really? Sarah was in it?
Yeah, that he was when she gave exit interviews, and then after.
But that was way later. I mean, we were like, Cass, yeah. Tony, and I were like preseason onward.
We thought like, that you guys were like the pre-jury trip.
Yeah, exactly. It was a great version. It was funny. Like the thing I loved about the meta of Kageyan mm-hmm. is that like while we were doing all that stuff, like Jeff was just fuming. He hated it.
Yep.
He wanted to like, he. That's why you had the ban.
San Wandel Sir couldn't
ban.
Tweet. Yeah.
Yeah.
this is only the second season Kelly Wentworth is on that she can tweet.
Like, yeah, but the ban or like the law is arbitrary because then the Dirty 30 was just like,
then they blew it up.
but yeah, Jeff was like, but what was funny about it is we like clearly helped the show. It was clearly good for the show. And Jeff was like, his cognitive dissonance was caving inward and imploding because like he was so mad at us doing it, but it was helping the buzz of the show. And then
you feel like more people watched it because the Kagyan cast was fighting on Twitter.
Not more people watched it, but more people like got invested emotionally in Survivor to the point that they will buy CBS All Access.
I don't know if I buy that theory.
Well, I guess it's for CBS to know.
Yeah.
And us to talk about.
All right, but okay, so you feel like that we've come full circle with the war dog.
Yeah. I think this guy, I don't know, I think he's pretty good at Survivor. Like, for all the talk about him, if you just watch the season, he's playing pretty damn well. He's reasoning things out. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with the decision to turn the tables on Chris.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, I agree with that. I probably don't agree with that decision. But he was effective at pulling it off, and I think that counts for something.
Yeah. I want to talk about Joe and how he's doing. And you and Joe had an interesting relationship in Survivor Cambodia. That, you know, you two were both sort of like the, you know, two of like the young phenoms of Survivor and came from it from probably very different perspectives of you
we
being
the two reasons that Brad Culpepper knew he wasn't getting on the season while we got our seating arrangements.
Yes. That, you know, Joe was sort of like, you know, the guy who was, you know, he could do anything. You were sort of like the guy who knew the game better than anybody. And you guys got together at the Merge and talked about Joe language, right?
I mean, I talked about Joe language in a bitchy little confessional, but
yes. Yes. So do you feel like have you become more Joe Anglem like?
Nah, man. Joe is like more in the new age school of all of these things.
I don't know any like, age. So what like so you and Joe wouldn't be vibing?
Joe's the type of guy who moves to Santa Monica and, you know, hangs out with Aris all the time and takes, you know,
you're
Instagram
obsessed
with
Aris.
No, I love Aris. I don't know why I've said his name three times. Joe's the type of guy who moves to Santa
Monica.
That's
Ozzy, I think.
No, Ozzy's in Venice, I think.
Ozzy's in Venice, okay.
I mean, Max Dawson knew all this stuff like 3 years ago, and that's how I remember it. Max Dawson was like, I was like, hey, do you want, we were going to get something to eat. And I was like, do you want to eat at this restaurant here? It looks pretty good. And he's like, no, let's go to Ozzy's restaurant in Venice. And, like, we took this huge drive just to like maybe bump into Ozzy. So we just kind of made do. But I feel like there was a point being made.
Well, I was asking, like, are you more Joe-like now? But you're saying that Joe would hang out in Santa Monica.
We actually talked a bit ago, and it was the best conversation we've had because we hadn't really clicked too much before. So that was cool. But, like, I wouldn't say I'm super like Joe at the same time. I think, like, I've cultivated skills that Joe has in terms of mindfulness, being in the moment. I mean, why do you think Joe dominates in challenges? It's not because he's like, he is good at puzzles, but he's not a puzzle whiz. Like, it's really because a lot of the Survivor challenges draw on a particular skill set, and that is being in the moment and concentrating on what you're doing. Like, and it's become increasingly a trend. You can go back and look and see this wasn't always how immunity challenges were. But now, after the merge, like probably from 13 or 12 down to 6, it's going to be, I don't know, 6 of 8 or 7 of 8 of those are going to be like hold this thing here and just concentrate and hold it in place and don't drop the thing or lose the balance or whatever.
Yeah. So when you spoke with Joe, what did you talk about?
If I may ask. Yeah, spirituality, meditation. We talked about Wim Hof method. That's a cool thing. You know Wim Hof?
No, who is he?
Oh, he's this guy who like does insane feats of holding your breath and breath stuff and withstanding the cold. Mm-hmm. And he's proven that through this method, you can control your autonomic immune system. But yeah, that's a whole nother thing. We talked about that. And like Joe was giving some tips on like how he's gotten into that and like his art. We're talking about art as well. Because mm-hmm. like, again, Joe and I are different in that he paints and I suck at painting. I put mm-hmm. one up on Instagram and it was, you know, you see why I'm not a painter. But mm-hmm. I am a writer. And yeah, so we can relate on that creative endeavor front.
Mm-hmm. See, I feel like that you have a lot in common now.
Yeah, to a degree. We've gotten there different ways, I would say. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Joe was kind of born comfortable with himself.
Yeah.
And never really had to fight to be comfortable with himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've been on quite a journey of becoming comfortable with myself.
But you're there now.
I don't think you're ever 100% there, mm-hmm. but I'm orders of magnitude more.
God knows I'm not, Spencer.
I mean, I think you're pretty comfortable. I think it depends on like the setting. Like if you put me in a club, I'm not going to be that comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But
see, that's the place where I'm the most comfortable.
In the club?
In Duck Club.
Duck Club. Well, part of Mr. Survivor was out at the club, so you're one third there. Yeah. If we were in Final Tribal Council, you would have just destroyed in terms of the first 33% of it. I think like for me, I found that it actually paradoxically, like it's a lot easier to draw it out of other people and then be comfortable with them because they're comfortable. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. In the past, I would try and like if I was meeting a new group, I would try and really figure out what they were like and really like play the right part. But now I'm just like kind of don't play any part, but like really like listening. I really like listening to someone else's strengths and seeing. I think everyone has like a best self that they can put forward. Anyone that you're going to say that person sucks has a better side they can show you. So it doesn't mean you shouldn't like, you know, have measures to stop someone who is truly awful from like ruining society. But I think like everyone can show you their light.
Okay. You talked about Bryce recently as being a light worker, and there was some confusion about what that meant.
Light workers basically are people who they share wisdom or things that resonate with people and make them comfortable, and just bring others up. They share whatever it is they share. I think they can come in many different forms. I also like, you know, is a light worker a literal thing, a physical thing? No. But
I think he thought you were saying that he like works on like a set with lights. He's like a gaffer.
No. You're tongue in cheek right now, right?
No, I think he was confused at first.
He was confused at first, but then like he Googled it and found this stuff. But yeah, like, I don't know. I think like social media is cool as long as you don't just stick in your own bubble, like create a prison of an echo chamber like War Dog. If you are willing to hear a variety of opinions on social media, it's really powerful because you can way more quickly discover a lot of these things. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, I probably wouldn't have done all the practices I've done if I didn't have like Eckhart Tolle on Instagram and others and like YouTube channels dedicated to self-development and spirituality, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Joe last night had a moment where he was standing behind Victoria when she was talking about Joe and Aubrey are a pair, and Joe overheard that, and then the camera panned to Joe. Did you ever have any moments like this with whether it was Tony in the spy shack or another survivor overhearing something that you didn't want them to hear?
Yeah, I had a few. That was a really funny moment, though, Victoria. I felt bad for her. I think she's a really good player. But yeah, deer in headlights. But yeah, like Tony was doing the spy shack stuff just constantly. So there were a few moments where we would like see a little orange flash tinge behind a tree and wonder if it was a butterfly or something else, and then look over and be like, did that tree just move, and walk over? And then he'd jump out and be like, you got me. But I don't know. It was kind of fun because like when you got that deep into it, that kind of became the culture of our season. You know, in the beginning of a season, you're more cautious. And so I think that's where you see Tony just shoot himself in the foot in Game Changers, because he tried to just make Kakian World be what Game Changers was. And, you know, that was like he went too hard with the like spy bunker.
Mm-hmm.
But in Kagyan, that was kind of how we all thought. Like, we were all really just like gaming, which was a really great fit and made it special for my first time.
Yeah. When Tony came back and it didn't go well, were you devastated?
No, I wasn't devastated. I mean, I care about him and I was sad. It mm-hmm. was my preference that Tony would do well.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I wasn't nearly as devastated as he was. I cared about him only insofar as it really upset him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Probably like you, like if I had been fine after Cambodia, you wouldn't have been too upset. You're just doing your job. It's another season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, I do get attached to the people that I meet through, you know, this, you know, this crazy world. And I do have a real, you know, a soft spot in my heart for Tony.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can't not. He just made that season so special. He's also just I think why you have a soft spot is because people love authenticity and Tony is completely authentic.
Like, he's as real as they get.
Is very. Yeah, it's pretty much him. It's like. He, at the finale, he was just acting part and parcel with what you saw, you know, at the season. And mm-hmm. he's just on. He's just, well, he's off sometimes. And when he's off, he's off.
But, yeah.
He goes balls to the wall.
I only met him one time. I got to shake his hand for about 5 seconds.
Did he sell you a t-shirt or was that not enough time?
No. I went to the Game Changers finale and he was sort of like with people like out in the front of the studio. Actually, you know what? Maybe it might have been the Millennials versus Gen X finale and they had him mm-hmm. as like one of the people they were going to bring on stage. And mm-hmm. I got to shake his hand for like a second. Like I was coming in and he was coming out. And it's like, oh my God, Tony, can't believe it in the flesh.
Yeah. Do you think the t-shirt company was a good move?
I don't even remember. He did like a whole t-shirt company.
He had like a campaign.
Yeah.
And on Twitter. I think he made a mistake by beginning this too early. Yeah. Like he began. What?
It was like he had like 4 or 5 different t-shirts. I'll ask Johnny Fairplay about, you know, where Tony went wrong.
That's like the move now. But yeah, Tony started like a campaign on Twitter, but he started it when he had like 200 followers when, you know, we were just announced.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think he got the legs he needed, but I thought it was impressive. Like he was slinging t-shirts at the finale. Like he sold a lot.
Oh, good. He's a hustler.
He had a huge trash bag full of t-shirts and was just like, I think he made money. I think.
Yeah, I remember that there were like the t-shirts had different themes and one of them was like hey, don't send cyber photos to people.
He was the predecessor of Rodney. Rodney is not the original, it turns out.
Yeah. This is a question we got for you, Spencer. Ron Clark, Survivor Ron Clark wrote
Ron
in
Clark.
And said, if you could change one decision you made, what would it be? And I'm not sure if he's referring to only Survivor.
So, yeah, I'm not sure he is either. And my response in the big picture, given he might not be, is the woo dog speech.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, obviously, it didn't matter too much for my game. But, like, I regret the moments where I was ugly to people.
Yeah.
And where I, like, yeah, I just know the mentality I was in then, and that's what I regret more. But as far as gameplay...
Well, okay, let's explore that for a second. So what is it that you regret about that?
You would rather be psychoanalyst than Survivor podcaster, it sounds like.
Look, I only have you for this amount of time. You know, we can talk about whatever else you want to talk about.
No, that's not a serious criticism. I'm just...
Yeah, I didn't take it. I would love to, you know, hear, you know, how your mind works on this stuff. And so, I know that I personally, one of my regrets is in Survivor of the Amazon, I said about Roger, if anybody remembers, that he was getting into an argument with another person on the season, Alex, and they were arguing about, I forget if it was gay marriage or if it was whether or not gay people should be allowed to have a baby. And Roger, you know, felt like, you know, he was like, you know, it's supposed to be between a man and a woman, and him and Alex like were getting into like a big argument over this. And I said in my confessional, I was like, oh, this is great for me because, you know, Roger is a bigot. And I think he was clearly wrong in his take. It was a terrible take, but then, you know, he's getting his family together and watching the show. And then, you know, everybody in his world, like, here's like on national television, Roger is a bigot. And I really felt bad that I said that about him. Like, I have the difference that, you know, I think he's wrong, but I didn't, you know, I felt like that, and he was very hurt that I said that.
I mean, I bet. I mean, you created something very uncomfortable for him. I've been there mm-hmm. In terms of watching the show.
It's not a good feeling.
No, not at all. Not mm-hmm. at all. But I think, like, sorry, go ahead.
Well, what was it that you were going with when you said that Wu was Tony's dog and your friend? Like, where did you feel like, okay, was that to hurt Wu? Was it to that you thought it was funny?
I mean, really, it just hurt me. Like, I don't think people looked at Wu much more negatively based on that. So it's almost selfish of me that I regret it. Mm-hmm. But also, like, I don't know, it did affect, like, maybe a juror or two and made them more anti-Wu, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I just generally don't think it's a good look.
And he could have turned that money into 30, 40 million by now after he invested.
That's true, actually. So, yeah, hey, what's there to regret? Wu is probably better for it. If Wu had won, he could have been Fabio. But now he's... Now he's Wu.
Yeah. I think I met Wu just one time also. Nicest guy.
Yeah, to an extent. Let's not get carried away. Yeah.
Like, I mean, look, I didn't get... I
the,
didn't
dude, the dude stole stuff. The dude was not...
Weasel Wu. Know,
not by... He wasn't by the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So you would change your jury speech. What about in the game?
I gotta say, in Kagayan specifically,
Ron Clark left it very open ended.
Okay, I'm only putting so much time. I think he could have meant
in your life. Clark.
In my life,
I don't know. He just said if you could change one decision you made, what would it be?
Dude, Ron, why do you have to do this, Ron? Like, this is so. You're like, he's asking, he's cheating. He's asking two questions in one. The question of how will I interpret this question and the question of how will I answer it.
That's what he does. He's an educator.
I don't know. I'm so like, when you're happy in the big picture, I don't think you regret things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard for me to get in touch with what I do regret. I would say, like, my biggest regret is that when I was really little, my dad would make my sister would cause a lot of trauma and pain for my sister.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like illegal child protective services or anything like that.
Yeah.
But he caused her a lot of pain, and I regret that I wasn't able to help her, because I don't know. The thing with regret is I'm not so convinced that we have free will. I think determinism is a pretty persuasive philosophical position. And so I don't really believe in, like, actually doing something different in the past, but I believe mm-hmm. in rethinking about, you know, emphasizing different aspects of the past when you think back on it. And I prefer a past where I was a source of some support, at least for Taryn, mm-hmm. my sister.
Mm-hmm. How much older are you than your sister?
Two and a half years.
Yeah. But you were a kid too.
Yeah, I was absolutely a kid too. And that's a lot of the guilt that I had to let go of. I always felt bad for not being able to save her from that, or even for, like, playing a prank on her with my friends or something, or, like, teasing her as kids do. And yeah, like, I could sit with that regret, but I was also a kid as well, and that was just kind of what we were born into, and we make the best of it now.
Okay. Kate Sears wants to know, when is your book coming out, Spencer?
I think sometime in 2020.
Okay.
If assuming she's talking about the book about mental disorder.
Well, what other book? Do you have a different book that you're working on?
TBA, Rob.
To be announced.
I mean, not soon, but TBA eventually.
Well, can you tell us what is? Is it a memoir?
No. I mean, the book about disorder will have a little bit of memoir aspect to it.
Mm-hmm.
But no, the other things I have in mind, I have multiple things in mind, perhaps fiction.
Well, but if you write a fiction book, I can get you on another podcast where you can talk about the origins for how you got the idea for the first paragraph of your book. Just putting that out there.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll call you as Jane when I'm ready.
I'll put you in touch with some people. Yeah. But have you written fiction before?
A short story.
Mm-hmm.
Short story. I have it somewhere here, but mm-hmm. But not extensively at all. So this is a long process. Like right now, I'm focused on the mental disorder book. And that's really the book I'm focused on now. I have other ideas, podcasting ideas, but one thing at a time, I would say.
Yeah.
A few things at a time, three things at a time.
Three things at a time.
That's, three things at a time.
Is that the rule? Is it the limit? Three things is the most people should take on?
Like, I think people's default in the West is to do a million things at a time. And then a lot of people try and counteract that and, mm-hmm. And claim that, no, it's all about the now. You need to just be a monk. Mm-hmm. And I kind of almost bought into that. I went to a monastery for a month in Nepal, and got the taste for that. But I think my middle way now is three things at a time.
Okay. What did you learn when you went to Nepal?
That meditation cultures across the world are vastly different.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just speculation, and I got the speculation from a guy named Daniel Ingram. He wrote a book called Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha. But basically, meditation cultures tend to develop in opposition to the broader culture they're situated. So Japanese Zen, extremely drab, plain, and disciplined amidst a very colorful Japan. Tibetan Buddhism, very colorful, very playful amidst a very bleak political situation. Burmese meditation culture, extremely rigorous, goal-oriented, and effective amidst a politically chaotic, choleric environment. United States New Age movement, in the most goal-oriented, capitalistic, striving culture in the history of the world, the least goal-oriented meditation culture.
Mm-hmm.
And there are exceptions. There are always exceptions. There are great places in the U.S., but Vipassana meditation or insight meditation, the tradition for Vipassana is that the teaching is free. Everywhere else in the world, the teaching is free. Vipassana centers are based purely, they run from donations. You take a course, and then if you wish to donate, you donate. And there are still some places in the U.S. that do that. Goenka retreats is the big one. But there are still some places that charge that are awesome, like International Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Maine. I've heard great things. But I was frustrated with the general culture in the U.S. that people aren't focused on enlightenment. People aren't focused on like the goal of this practice. It's kind of, and it goes back to the origins of meditation, really. Like meditation kind of was associated with psychedelics and all of these stigmatized, scary mm-hmm. things in the 1960s during the countercultural movement. And it was a fringe activity, and people thought it was very woo-woo, foreign, and fringe. And so then the turning point really came through science. Like these Western paradigms that are so important to us, like science and medicine, started to legitimize meditation. The founder of transcendental meditation said that Western science is compatible with meditation. And then, you know, you had Jon Kabat-Zinn and doing mindfulness-based stress reduction, which sort of was a big splash in medicalizing meditation and using it to treat things like all these different diseases and anxiety and so on. And so you got this medical and scientific legitimization, and meditation becomes an industry. Now, in this media digital age, meditation is a $1.2 billion industry. Apps mm-hmm. like Headspace and Calm, 10% Happier is how I started, so I'm partial to that. But these things have gotten so huge. It's not just apps, but it's a huge industry, and an industry where there's a lot of profit involved. There's a lot of temptation to make money from spreading mindfulness and getting people in the door and getting them in the door quickly and getting them in the door without warning. And that's where you get into trouble, because this is a practice that was originally designed to destroy your sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extremely existentially threatening thing that you're doing when you do Vipassana meditation, or when you go on a 10-day retreat, for instance, even when you meditate for 20 minutes. I mean, people have gotten into interesting meditation territory simply when dancing, or an actress or an actor trying to get very embodied and notice their breath. It can happen even from that. It can happen, you know, it just depends on everyone has a different threshold, but you can get into this interesting meditative territory that poses dangers. Like often people have this experience, there are maps of meditation. Okay. So like in the Visuddhimagga text of the 5th century from Sri Lanka, you have the first iteration of this now modern form of modeling the meditative path. So it's the stages of insight, and it's 16 stages that you go along as you do serious meditation. And a lot of people will get to the 4th stage, the arising and passing away, which is what happened to me, and have this really weird, like mystical seeming experience where, you know, I'll probably another time on another podcast, I'll go into detail about it, but for here and now, it's just a mind-blowing experience that makes you, it made me rethink materialism and a lot of science, and change my perspective on sort of reality. And after that comes a lot of difficulties, often, not necessarily, and I don't know how much of a believer I am in this specific model, but according to this model, which has been validated anthropologically even in work like the varieties of contemplative experience studies at Brown. I think it was Jared Lindahl. There's been validation of these models whereby you get in, you have difficulties as you get really into meditation, and like very sadly, grave consequences have come from people meditating. Like in Pennsylvania, there was a girl who left a 10-day meditation retreat that was intensive, having previously not had any mental health issues other than anxiety and no reason to cause people in her life concern. She left the meditation retreat suicidal and ultimately died by suicide. And the story of these possibilities is swept under the rug by this desire now in the West to just spread meditation as some lifestyle decision, like adequate sleep or like a good diet. That is just one more thing to check off. It can be a lot more than that. And I do think, like, I guess what I've been saying for the last 5 minutes is somewhat of a warning, just to don't become in your head and obsessive and go and memorize all these stages of meditation and think you can figure out how you're going to proceed through them, because that you really can't do. But be aware that for some people, negative effects do occur from meditation. And seek out guidance and use teachers and retreats, which are amazing resources, if you're willing to go to that point and if you're willing to take that risk.
Sounds like what you're saying about meditation is the same thing you're saying about Survivor, of that just like, you know, be the super fan of like, think you can memorize everything and then just show up and think it's going to work out okay.
100%. And furthermore, in terms of your life and things that matter more than Survivor, think long and hard about if you want to go on Survivor, because it messes with some people's lives. Like Tyson gave a confessional where he said it makes some people angry. And it does. It leaves some people worse off than when they started.
Okay. Spencer, is there anything else you want to address? Aren't there
questions?
There are questions, but there are things that I feel like that are almost trivial to, you know, in terms of what we're talking about. Do you want to look at the questions? You are the king of social media.
Because they thought they were here for Survivor conversation and they get this metaphysical.
Well, I think that those people are probably gone, you know, this far in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that is, I don't know. You could do this. But I don't know. I just like talking to
you, man. Well, all right. Well, let's, let me see if there's anything else. Scott Chernoff. Great podcaster, funny guy. How has Survivor changed in the 10 seasons since you started? And now that it's been on that long, do we still call you the young lad?
Always call me the young lad. But yeah, it's changed. I think like the biggest change that's interesting to me is the meta of Survivor, and especially the production itself, releasing all these pictures of behind the scenes, showing like, oh, this is what the medical stuff looks like. This is a picture of a producer giving an interview. Like, this is what the marooning looks like. I think they're like enjoying playing with the fourth wall toward the end of the show.
Mm-hmm. Could you relate at all to when you were with Juicy J about whether that Big Wendy wanted to let the chickens out when you were there with Kimmy and with Jeremy?
I loved that line by Riddick, bleeding heart hypocrites. Mm-hmm. That was really good. I mean, I don't know. My heart goes out to Wendy too, because I had to kill a chicken or I chose to kill a chicken, and it was a very unpleasant experience.
Yes.
Like, to become conscious of what you're doing actually in the world by eating meat is hard to do. But
are you a vegetarian?
No.
No.
But I'm also not a bleeding heart hypocrite, mm-hmm. so I don't admonish anyone. But mm-hmm. I do think it's a worthwhile experience for someone who eats meat to kill an animal mm-hmm. That they're going to eat, of course, not for sport. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a worthwhile experience to become conscious of that if that's what your behavior is causing.
Okay. Then Amanda Fallon wants to know, what is your favorite Spencer gif? Do you have one?
Probably the one where it looks like I'm jacking off.
You like that? That's your favorite.
I think that's like the top one. So I feel like a legacy isn't always something you get to choose. And I might as well just contribute momentum toward the legacy that seems to have my thralls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have a second favorite?
I'm looking it up now. I don't really know them by heart. Mm-hmm. there's one of me putting my socks on. That's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Probably one of me like getting immunity, blowing out air very intensely because it was such a big moment for me.
Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of talk this season about people talking about their Survivor checklist. Did you have a Survivor checklist?
Yeah, that was Aubrey. That was touching. Like when Aubrey was saying she always wanted to find an idol mm-hmm. and have that feeling. Like,
yeah. And there's also some talk about the Survivor checklist from the previous episode talking about I want to cross a blind side off my Survivor checklist.
Yeah. I've never been blindsided and the person voted out. Mm. That's something I miss.
It's overrated.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm not going to complain about that.
Do you have any relationship with Aubrey?
A little. I mean, she's reached out to me from time to time. I think all of us Final Tribal Council losers have a little bit of a bond. Mm-hmm. Whether you're Aubrey, who like played just as well as Michelle, or whether you're, I don't know, the specialist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think we all still have a little bit of a bond just in, that's the ultimate in, I think, I don't know, maybe it's worse than a blind side. I can't speak from experience, but having, you know, having, unless you propose
it lasts
to the
longer.
Other finalists before the announcement,
mm-hmm.
But it's like the ultimate in thinking you've got it and then having the rug swept out from under you.
Mm-hmm. What did you feel like that you were going to win when you got to the Final Tribal Council in Cambodia?
Well, I was obsessed at that time with like law of attraction and the secret and all this stuff. And like
yes.
was trying to think positive. So I was like, even though I was terrified of Jeremy, I'm like, I have a 50-50 shot. I have a 50-50 shot. I could do it. I just have to do really well at Final Tribal Council.
Mm-hmm.
And so going in, yeah. And then Final Tribal Council.
So you would visualize that you would go to the Final Tribal Council and you would kill it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But I think my problem was I wasn't connecting my visualization, I think, is effective.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm not fully off the bandwagon of those things. I just have a more nuanced understanding of those things. And like my mistake was I wasn't connecting my visualization to something I had control over. Like RS fell into this in Blood vs. Water when he was saying he was okay. I don't know why I'm referencing RS every other breath. Maybe it's because he's my shaman. I can't confirm it. but he fell into this in Blood vs. Water when he's like, I'm just visualizing Jeff saying the winner of Survivor is RS. That's not something RS can control. Like the way Jeff announces him as the winner is in no way related to his decisions as a human body.
Mm-hmm.
And so, whereas I should have been visualizing killing it at Final Tribal, I was just visualizing like Spencer wins Survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so like, I think I did okay at Final Tribal Council, but I obviously couldn't help but learn over the course of Final Tribal Council that I wasn't going to win.
Do you think that you would be in a better place today here in 2019 if you had won Survivor Cambodia than having not won it?
I mean, you could call this like extreme cognitive dissonant justification and self-validation, self-soothing, but I think I would be in a way worse place. I remember my path and my idea of how life would go if I won was, yeah, that'll be great. Then I've got $1 million or $600,000 cushion, and then I can continue to my job as a trader and be the best trader and just live in a nice condo and have a great life. And like, that's what having a great life was to me. And I think if that had happened, that would have been pretty sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So are you more at peace with how everything ultimately played out in that season with that space?
Yeah, absolutely. There was part of it that like you have to be at peace with what happens. If you keep brooding forever, you'll eat yourself alive. Mm-hmm. But truly, yeah, I think everything happens for a reason, and I think there was certainly a reason. I mean, I don't know. I'm open-minded. Like I am not saying any of these theories are true, but perhaps something happened when Kelly and Keith and I went on that reward in Cambodia and went to the temples and were blessed by the Cambodian monks. I think that's possible.
What was that blessing?
To, you know, try and walk the spiritual path, to live a different type of life.
Mm-hmm. And is Keith Nail walking a different kind of life now?
I think Keith Nail was already pretty zen.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's the thing about Zen. I feel like you don't know how it's going to look. And I feel like what we really lack in the world is people who are pretty spiritually attained, but who speak in a normal-ish way, you know, because I mean, Eckhart Tolle is, you know, enlightened as hell. Mm-hmm. But when he starts a speech by not talking for a minute, 90% of the casual YouTube audience just tuned out. Mm-hmm. And when he starts talking about the now, mm-hmm. in that way, people just think spirituality is something other than them. So I have, like, honestly, maybe Keith is like in a really good spot. Maybe Keith is a great guy to learn from.
You said that you think everything happens for a reason, and you earlier mentioned about determinism. I feel like this was something that in your conversation with Richard Hatch that you sort of were getting on opposite sides of the aisle, and that you do believe in destiny. You do believe in fate.
I don't know that we use those words. So I'll just talk about the Hatch thing first. What Hatch and I disagreed about was whether it's the truth or whether it's my truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to say, I don't think my truth is fate. Like, I think there's a free will side to it as well. And this is not a reason to just say, like, whatever happens in life, who cares? There's a lot to do. Like, there's a ton to do that you should do. Work that has to be done. But just, like, it can be playful and enjoyed to be done. But anyway, the Hatch thing, like, Hatch was saying that he thinks reality is one thing. And this is my interpretation of what he said, so I'd love a rebuttal, Richard. But he thinks reality is one thing, and whether you look at it or not, or whether you analyze it effectively or not, it is what it is, and it's there to be understood. And I would suggest that the findings of quantum mechanics, especially since like special relativity theory in the early, you know, in like 1915 or 1905, I guess, like that helped us understand large objects and fast objects very well. It reconceptualized what we thought was space and time from Isaac Newton and understood now as one thing together, space-time. But from that, we realized we still can't really predict things. Even if we know space-time perfectly, we can't on this level, on the relative level of humanity, and especially on the microscopic cellular level, we can't predict things. So when we use quantum mechanics to try to predict things, we realize that we can't know both the speed and the position of a particle at the same time. It's impossible. And furthermore, if you do light experiments where you put light through slits one particle at a time, it can actually form patterns it would form as if it were a wave, which is crazy and completely subverts our idea of there being a such thing as a particle, or there being a such thing as the smallest fundamental thing that you can analyze.
Mm-hmm.
Quantum mechanics suggests that that doesn't exist. that the Buddhist idea and Buddhist philosophy of nothingness is just as valid an epistemological explanation of reality as is like someone like Jerry Fodor, a physicalist, pointing out whatever it is now, quarks, the smallest thing, that those actually are just as valid as one another, that there's no reason our Western paradigms are actually superior. Certainly they have more predictive power, and that's enabled technology, and that's a beautiful thing. But there's no reason to assume they describe reality more accurately. And furthermore, if you look in quantum mechanics at where particles actually are, they basically are in probability waves of where they could be. They don't exist in any one place. They're just in probability waves of where they could show up. And only when you look at where they are, do they materialize to be in one place. Suggesting that, you know, mind and observation actually is creating reality, not just perceiving it, but affecting what it is. So I do truly believe that my truth is different from your truth, that you could have been told one thing about some group or some concept, and I could have been told a different thing about some group or some concept. And because of what we were told, we're going to see different aspects of it. Like someone who believes all the people who go on Survivor are just basket cases and losers will see support for that. And someone who believes that everyone who goes on Survivor is on a spiritual quest, and that Survivor is the church of the 21st century, and Jeff Probst is the minister, will see evidence of that and glorify Survivor and believe in Survivor gods. And like there's literal scientific evidence for that. That's what's so amazing about this time right now, is we're seeing a convergence between scientific evidence and these metaphysical things that would previously just be written off as fringe or as woo-woo. We're actually seeing that in the reticular activation system of the brain, what you focus on, you literally see more. You literally see more evidence for. It changes what you pick out of reality to believe to be true.
Spencer, I don't even know where to go from that.
I don't know. You
make it sound so easy.
I don't have it figured out. I'm just raising questions.
Yeah. I don't know.
That's a form of meditation, self-inquiry, raising questions, asking these things we assume to be true. We assume to be axioms of science. Who am I? What is this? What is another person? What is seeing?
Spencer, but
I get the sense that the podcast has reached a natural conclusion.
I think it's a permanent ebb. I'm, you know, totally open to if there's anything else that you want to discuss, get into. But I think we've blown people's minds today.
Yeah, but we haven't broken any records. What's the record? Not for today, but what's the record?
For a podcast? I think I did a podcast that was like 4 hours and 15 minutes with Tyson. But that was before he had any kids. I only had one.
Okay, well, hey, I'm not having kids anytime soon, and your kids are getting easier to take care of. So
that's true.
I think maybe sometime in the future, there's an opening.
What if Spencer 1.0 got this podcast delivered to him on some sort of a time traveling iPod?
That's so hard to predict. I think it's a binary. I think it's either he would have turned it off within 20 seconds, or he would have angrily listened to the whole thing and slowly allowed what was said to seep in and to influence him to try things out and walk a different path.
Who knows?
Only one man behind the curtain.
Spencer, I really appreciate you coming on here and talking with me and being so open that I can tell you that there will be people that will have loved this, and there will be people that will absolutely have hated this. And
you think so? Really?
I do think so. But what I admire about you is that you seem like you are in a place where you are very comfortable with that. That's fine. That it's then
yes.
it was not for you then, if you are one of the people. And that's one of the things that I wrestle with constantly, of being comfortable with the, that's fine, this was not for you, where, and I really admire that you seem to have the courage of your conviction to be able to not care about what people are saying.
Thanks, big dog. I think like the best Survivor players and characters often have some haters. I mean, Angelina, I guess, was the latest in a long line of rabble rousers and big polarizing characters, as Jeff likes to say. So I'm excited to keep watching and hopefully podcasting about
it. Well, one of the things that I'm learning on my journey is that, you know, it's hard to have lovers if you also don't have haters. That if you aren't worth hating, then there's also a degree where you're not worth caring about. If you're just trying to be, you know, all things to all people, well, then why should anybody care about you?
I would take being loved and hated over no one giving a shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I believe you have arrived. I believe you're here.
You have to hold your hand out now, like in that painting. Was it Picasso? The one where he's touching Adam, making him a real person.
Is that what happened? Is that what you're doing to me, or is that what I'm doing to you?
I thought that was what you were going to do to me, but alas, we're on Skype and and not really face to face.
Yeah.
I guess we'll have to wait.
But Spencer, that I'm happy to hear that you are doing well. I'm sorry about everything you're going through.
Thank you.
With your dad. But I really do, you know, value our friendship that we've been able to build over the years. You're one of the people that, you know, I've really, you know, I've come to know you as like as a younger person, and we've, you know, gotten to know each other as well over the years. I really was, you know, I really felt badly when I thought you were, you know, not doing well after that second time that you played. And I really felt guilt in that. I felt like that I partially contributed to your suffering that you were going through.
No,
during that, because I felt for a couple of different reasons of like sort of like, you know, putting like you know, unrealistic expectations on you, and you know, you were, you know, so open with your time and doing, you know, a million podcasts before you went out there, and then, you know, there was you know, when everything happened with you and Steven in the game, that I really felt like that I didn't know the best way to handle that. And I really felt like that was, you know, really conflicted in terms of how do I even talk about this on the podcast? And I felt like that the way that I ultimately did I handled it in a way where I feel like that there were people who felt like, hey, these are my friends, which was how I felt. But, you know, that I felt like I could have done more to stop a backlash from people that were in the fan base about how could, you know, why could Spencer decide to do something like this?
Yeah, but, you know, misunderstanding is going to happen no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you should beat yourself up over your role in it or lack of a role in it, because it's inevitable.
Yeah. I just felt like that, but I felt like ill-equipped to be able to handle that. And that's what really, you know, added to, you know, I felt that you were so sad after the season, and I felt like you know, that part of it was having to do with, you know, a backlash during the season.
Yeah. Well, that is the case. But I guess what I would say is that backlashes can be great as long as the roller coaster goes back up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm happy to hear that you are doing well and feel like that you are on the right path. You've turned into, you know, a real, you know, bad boy of Survivor now. Something that, you know, I really
look up to.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you ever seen the show Nathan For You?
Yes.
Yeah. I love when he's like creating the fake dating show, and he's like, I am a bit of a bad boy.
Yeah, you were, you know, safe, Spencer. Everybody would have been happy if their little girl brought Spencer home, but now you're a wild man.
Don't take that from me, though. I mean,
well, I don't know. That people say, like, hey, when he's talking about mushrooms and
that's true.
He's reinventing how people are looking at the universe.
Technologically in it. In advanced in-laws, I think.
yes.
On advanced, like, I don't know, or just open-minded people.
Yes. Okay. Well, those are, you know, few and far between.
That's true. Increasingly few and far between, which makes the world fun, but really twisted.
Yeah. Will you do a 5-hour podcast with Richard Hatch?
Hell yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that guy could do a 10-hour podcast probably, but I'm down for a 5-hour podcast.
I'll never forget when I...
Wait. Oh, go ahead.
When I lost on Survivor All-Stars, he was somebody who... He came out next after me. And I looked at him and I was like, okay, well, this is like some validation for me because I lost in it. And, you know, but
the
now
OG.
Richard Hatch lost too. What are they doing? They're getting rid of all the good people. And then I said, okay.
That's what happens every time. It's not an accident. I mean, there's a reason Sierra Dawn went deep in Game Changers. Like and there's a reason Sarah won. The biggest targets always get pounded down. I mean, look at my situation going into Cambodia. Sure. Like, it's inevitable.
Sure.
That's why, like, Christian, wait, take your time. I know you don't want to listen to this, but take your time.
Yeah. But just in terms of that, so Richard Hatch showed up, and I felt like, okay, now he and I, now we're really going to put our heads together. I'm going to really pick Richard. Here's the good news. I'm going to be, you know, be best pals with Richard Hatch. That wasn't how it worked, Spencer. He was not super interested in, you know,
wait,
hanging
are you just
out.
Jealous that Richard likes me better?
No. I'm not jealous. I'm just saying that one of the things he did say at that time was that he said, you know, the greatest thing I ever learned was not caring what other people think about me. The other people.
Oh, yeah.
And that will stick with me forever. That he said that then. He just like was pretty much going to go about his own business and then, you know, was not really interested in doing a lot of socializing. I've had great conversations with him after the fact. But, you know, at that point in time, he's just like, yeah, you know, I'm going to do my own thing.
Yeah, I mean, fuck. It slipped my tongue.
But he does not care what other people say about him.
Right, that he doesn't. I don't know where I was going with that, man.
Okay.
Spencer. What were we talking about before?
Everything.
Okay. Yeah, you can cut this out or leave it in, either way.
No, I think it's perfect.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Spencer, what's a hashtag for all this?
Aris Obsession.
Aris is doing great, by the way. I think that you know, the Survivor fans haven't heard him on the podcast and wonder what he's up to. But
I was talking to Tyson recently. Tyson was like, oh, Aris, like, I wonder how he's doing. I'm like, I bet you Aris is in a good spot.
He, you know, I don't know anything about how he's, you know, what his, but financially and business wise, that they are.
Stay at home dad living the dream.
I mean, their company is killing it. So,
He works for it too, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, yeah.
So
no, they're killing it. I wasn't me. There's no condescension there.
I think it's fine. I think you're fine. Spencer, what's next for you?
You asked that already. And, I don't know. I'm living in the
now. I said exactly like that though.
I don't know. But next, what's next? I have nothing for you.
Okay, that's fine.
No, I'm doing well though. I'm happy.
Okay, are you done with the social media blitzkrieg?
The blitzkrieg is definitely over, but
that's over.
I'm not done with social media. I will, a retreat's definitely in order. Whether it's a self retreat or whether I might go to the Insight Meditation Society 3-month retreat this fall.
A retreat that's 3 months long.
Yeah, perhaps a retreat that's 3 months long.
It's a very long retreat.
Yeah, it is long.
What do you do for 3 months?
Nice life. What?
What do you do for 3 months?
Meditate.
Meditate. That's
if
it.
If I were to ever go on Survivor again, that's actually what I would do. I would just be like, look, this game has caused me enough pain. It's now my meditation retreat. And I'm going to meditate there.
Yeah. Would you participate in the challenges?
Yeah, I would have to, but I would.
Would you
go
to tribal council?
All the other time would be dedicated to meditation. Even tribal council, I would meditate.
You would meditate during tribal council.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as we were ready to vote, I would stop meditating.
And Jeff would be like, all right, Spencer, gotta know. What are you doing? You're not paying attention. Your eyes are closed.
I would open my eyes and say, are they closed or have they been open?
So, and this is for strategy, or this is for then you would be
strategy of enlightenment, and enlightenment being what matters.
You might win.
I honestly think like everyone else would just eat each other. They'd be like, we can take Spencer out anytime.
He's not a threat to anybody.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a threat to a single person.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
it would be a little bit rough going at first because I would have to like break Jeff in. I would have to, you know, we would be at the marooning and he'd be like, so Spencer, you said you didn't even want to play again before and now you're back. And when I didn't respond, I think he'd be pretty pissed.
Yeah, he'd get very angry.
I'd have to navigate that skillfully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
Might have to do a little concession.
Well, this might be a compelling reason to come back.
No, I said I wouldn't go back.
Okay. All right. Well, Spencer, thank you for everything here today. And everybody wishes you nothing but the best. Oh, I wanted to ask you, what was the most common question you got when you did all the AMAs on Reddit?
Like, how long did it take to get used to the cameras?
That's the question that people care about?
Well, the most common is always shitty. Like, even on Reddit, the best questions are going to be more refined and rare, and then you're going to have a shitty common question. And in real life, it's even worse. In real life,
sure.
The most common question...
Where do you go to the bathroom? How was it? Did you survive? Yeah.
What was that like?
What was the best question you got on Reddit?
I think I really liked a question that was like, how many times during your Survivor experience did you feel like it was 50-50, you might be voted out, you might not? And what was that feeling in your body like? What was the anxiety associated with that like? I love that question.
Yeah. Let me see. Should I look on your Instagram too? What's going on?
Yeah, if you want.
Okay.
I got a lot of Twitter notifications, I guess, from this, probably.
From this. Do you see a question that you want to field before?
Says, what happens when we die?
Somebody wanted to know that? And what happens?
You know, if dying is the ego dying, then that's the we dying, and it's not something we can know.
Mm-hmm.
Are you trying to get me hard? Says Nelson Bronco.
Mm-hmm.
Who's that? He's verified.
Yeah. He's a reporter in Canada.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right. Let's see.
So is that final AMA ever going to get some answers? But do you think I should, or do you think I should just chill out, Rob?
I think that this should suffice for people for a while.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that, you don't want to be overexposed. I think that the Blitzkrieg was magical because... You had not been around for a while, but I think that if you keep this up for another week, I think that you just become, people are used to you. And then I think you need to, take your foot off the gas for a while.
All right. Foot off the gas. Coming to you live from my apartment. Rob and I are here and we are about to start the first annual Gilmore Girls podcast.
Yes.
Rob. How are you?
That's it. I know that. I mean, you've teased people with the Gilmore Girls for how many years that you're going to do this podcast?
I mean, sometimes what people like is the tease more than the actual thing.
So you're the dog chasing the car, but what will happen if you actually catch the car?
I think that's the point. You don't really want to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So next summer, Spencer's Gilmore Girl podcast. All right, Spencer, thank you for all the time today, and really appreciate you being so open and sharing so much, and I love you, buddy.
I love you too. Thanks, big dog.
All right, everybody, there you have it. Spencer Bledsoe, and that was one of the most wild interviews that we've ever had on Robin's podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. If you're still here, I'm gonna guess that you did. Again, not for everybody, but it was a lot of fun for me to catch up with Spencer and hear everything that he is doing. A lot of Survivor podcasts still to come this week. Don't worry. Johnny Fairplay, Megan Z, Wiggle Room still to come. So we'll get to it all. Thanks so much to the patrons of Rob's Podcast. Make all of this podcasting possible. For more information on how to be a part of our patron community, check out rob.com/patron. Thanks for everybody for listening. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.